You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
I'm currently on a book tour around the United States and hope to see you. Find the schedule of my events at warisalie.org. It is my privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Dr. Gregory Shupak. He has a PhD in literary studies and teaches media studies at the University of Guelph in Toronto. He is an activist and a fiction writer, and his political analysis, which we'll be talking about, appears regularly in Jacobin, Middle East Eye, and elsewhere. Greg Shupak, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. I read a couple of articles that I want to bring up by you recently. One is called The Case Against Bombing ISIS, and the other is called Abolish the Military. Let's start with the first one and see where it goes and hopefully
sure.
Get to the second. What is the case against bombing ISIS?
I guess to put it in the most concise terms possible, I would describe it as the following, that the U.S.-led campaign against ISIS, the military campaign against ISIS, is or has already resulted in a fairly large number of civilian casualties, just over 1,000 at minimum, last time I checked. And I think that considering that this war doesn't in any way address the underlying causes that gave rise to ISIS and is in fact a further enactment of some of the very causes that did lead to the rise of ISIS, I think that those civilian deaths are likely to be in vain, and that even if this particular configuration that we call ISIS is defeated in some sense, that's not going to actually bring any kind of peace and security to the people living in the region, but perhaps empower another similar group or create conditions under which a comparable group that we haven't heard of yet comes into existence.
These civilian casualty figures, I mean, these are sort of what's called passive reporting, right? I mean, this is what turns up in the news, where when scientific studies have gone and been done door to door and so forth afterwards, as in Iraq, the casualties end up being much higher than anybody thought. What do we really know so far in terms of civilian deaths in the campaign against ISIS?
Yeah, I mean, exactly as you say, it is a very conservative method of arriving at these totals. So the most recent, to be more precise, figure that I see as of right now, according to airwars.org, which is a very useful organization for reporting on civilian casualties in this conflict, the most up-to-date number they have is 1,057 minimum civilians likely killed in Iraq and Syria by the U.S.-led coalition. But the threshold that they have for arriving at that number is pretty rigorous. They are going on, they're arriving at that figure based on casualties that they can confirm through, as you say, external reports or media reports. As we've seen in Iraq, that type of research leads to much lower casualty figures than when one saw the type of research done by The Lancet, which carried out the types of methods that I think you were describing that paint a much more dire picture when these kind of aggregate models are put into place and you end up arriving at calculations where there's over 1 million dead or many, many hundreds of thousands of civilians dead in Iraq. So I think it's perfectly reasonable to conclude that this figure of just over 1,000 that I refer to is actually a lot lower than is the reality. And in fact, the Air Wars website will always also note what the reported or claimed number of civilians are. So in other words, civilian casualties that they cannot verify, and those are upward of around 3,000 last I saw. So, I mean, I think it's perfectly plausible that something closer to that is what the total is at this stage. But as you suggest, once on the ground, really systematic research is carried out, it's I think no stretch to imagine that we could be looking at much, much higher totals once we take into account not just bombing, but also things like the lives lost due to infrastructure damage, due to people fleeing the bombing, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, absolutely. People are literally starving to death, and all of this these resources are going into bombing rather than getting them food. The other thing is this word, civilian. I mean, we're distinguishing the civilian deaths from the non-civilian deaths, presumably because the non-civilian deaths are a good in themselves, which some of us might not agree with, or they serve some greater purpose. but if we're going to make the case that this is not serving some greater purpose, then maybe we have to consider all deaths to be a downside to the operation. I mean, is it in vain, as you say, that they're going to continue trying to destroy ISIS, or is it actually counterproductive? Is it actually something that ISIS desires?
I think it's both. I think it's in vain and counterproductive. I think those are sort of two consequences that are fused, in the sense that we can't in any way rationalize the deaths of civilians. And as you say, I think there's a good case to be made about to think critically about what civilians actually means when we distinguish it from fighters in this type of context. But I think that there's definitely benefits for ISIS from having this type of campaign enacted. I mean, it forces, for one thing, makes people more dependent upon them in the territories that they control, and it adds to their prestige, in a sense, to say, okay, well, you know, ISIS is fighting the Western forces that have wrought such devastation in the region, and look, now they're here they are doing it again. So, I mean, I think it's something that will, at least in certain quarters, add to ISIS's prestige.
Yeah, the weirdest thing about ISIS, as numerous past examples of such groups, is that it is presented to the U.S. public as having come out of nowhere in 2014. Where do you think ISIS came from?
Well, I mean, I think that there's a pretty strong record of evidence that it has come out of a combination of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. I talk about this at some length in my Jacobin article, The Case Against Bombing ISIS. So you have people like Lydia Wilson, an Oxford researcher who has interviewed imprisoned ISIS fighters, and her conclusions are that there's a very, very direct link between the U.S. invasion and destruction and occupation of Iraq and the rise of ISIS. And I mean, she's far from the only one. She quotes Douglas Stone, a U.S. general who oversaw Iraqi detainees in Iraq during the U.S. occupation, and he says that, quote, every single detainee, end quote, that he encountered in the prison complained about the disintegration of security brought on by the American invasion. I could go on listing similar types of observations, but to speak to your other question, to speak to the other half of the question, Syria, we see a different scenario, but nevertheless a key role played by the United States in terms of laying the groundwork for ISIS. So the U.S. government has had a longstanding desire to replace the Syrian government with someone more reliable in this, or someone more pliable, you might say. It's true that there have been times when the Syrian government has worked with the U.S. government to, render U.S. detainees and so on, or in the 1991 Gulf War. Nevertheless, if you look at something like the WikiLeaks documents on Syria, it's quite clear that the Bush administration had a very strong desire to overthrow the Syrian government, and that the Obama administration, despite a bit of a change in rhetoric, never really abandoned the regime change strategy in Syria. And since the, well, actually, I was going to say since the outbreak of war in Syria, but it actually predates that, when the WikiLeaks documents suggest there was an effort to foster sectarian discontent in Syria by the U.S. government. Once that actually came to manifest itself, I suppose, in the Syrian war, the U.S. and particularly its allies, Turkey probably the most, but also Qatar, Saudi Arabia, played at Jordan as well, played a major role in fostering the sectarian Sunni-led Takfiri forces, many of which found expression in ISIS or in very similar groups, whether that's Jabhat al-Nusra, the al-Qaeda formation in Syria, or the al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria, I should say. And more generally, arming all kinds of Syrian opposition groups, and just as importantly, perhaps more importantly, undermining efforts for a negotiated settlement in Syria, I think creates the types of conditions that are ideal for ISIS, which is horrendous warfare and societal collapse.
Yeah, we're speaking with Gregory Shupak about his articles in Jacobin, including the case against bombing ISIS. It seems like, obviously, Syria is a very complex situation and has included numerous forces, including legitimate grievances against the government by the people of Syria. But what I think is most interesting here, and I think you agree in your article, and you cite a U.S. government report from 2012 that the United States has not been just arming al-Qaeda without knowing it or trying to overthrow the government with some sort of plan for what comes next, but has knowingly expected that it would create disaster and the sort of forces that you see in ISIS and has continued down this path anyway. Is that right?
Absolutely, absolutely. So what you're referring to is the Defense Intelligence Agency report from 2012, which can be, aspects of it can be interpreted in different ways. But nevertheless, it remains true that the document does say the West, Turkey, and the Gulf states supported the Syrian opposition and admits that the Syrian war could result in the creation of a Salafist principality in eastern Syria, and notes, and I quote, that this is exactly what the supporting powers to the opposition want in order to isolate the Syrian regime. We had comments from U.S. General Martin Dempsey telling the Senate Armed Services Committee in 2014 that America's Arab allies, as he put it, we're funding ISIS, and Joe Biden said the same also in 2014, though he quickly tried to walk that back. So, I mean, it's certainly the case that, yes, I'm not suggesting that the entire opposition to the Syrian government is some U.S. government plot. What I am suggesting is that the U.S. role in Syria has made life much worse for Syrians and has needlessly prolonged the war and empowered some of the worst elements of the Syrian opposition. So, you know, as much as one would like Syrians to have a better government than they currently do, the point to keep in mind here is that the United States policy is not in any way geared towards giving Syrians a more democratic future or some human rights respecting government. It's rather an effort to replace the current government of Syria with somebody amenable to the United States, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and Qatar. And if you look at all of those governments, you can see that human rights and democracy are not overriding concerns of theirs.
To say the least. It seems like the U.S. public is often given by the media a sort of cartoonish idea of overthrowing governments or overthrowing terrorist organizations / governments like ISIS, with this idea that if certain leaders were murdered and the organization was shut down, all would be well. It doesn't take into account poverty and resentment and violence and grievances and armaments and underlying factors. And I think you make a couple of good points in your article that if somehow ISIS ceased to exist, a new organization with a different name would take its place, or ISIS would move its operations to Libya or Yemen, where the United States is facilitating the growth of similar organizations. Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, Libya is a particularly useful case for if we're thinking about Syria in the sense that, okay, well, yeah. So the U.S. very directly carried out a full scale. Well, the U.S. and its allies in NATO and in the Gulf carried out a full blown military intervention in Libya. And yeah, okay, so the dictator's overthrown in Libya. Well, look what has resulted since. I mean, a complete complete collapse of the society, total wanton violence, and complete political instability, with a lot of factions in power that have carried out some pretty ugly violence, such as the ethnic cleansing of the Tuerga, for example, one of the black African communities in Libya. As you're suggesting, it's not as though we can just say, okay, well, yeah, replace Gaddafi, replace Saddam Hussein, replace Bashar al-Assad, and somehow this solves all of the problems in those societies. I would also add that one reason that doesn't happen is that, the U.S.'s foreign policy goals are not to actually bring, democracy, human rights, prosperity, and security to any of these countries. It's rather to dominate them. And that's by its that set of goals, which I try to explain and offer evidence for in the Case Against Bombing ISIS article, I think is a pretty clear reason as to why we can't expect democracy and human rights respecting governments in countries where the U.S. carries out a regime change. We can't expect democracy and human rights to emerge because that's not what the U.S. is trying to install anyway. So why would the outcome resemble that when that's not even the goal?
Yeah, I think you do make a good case in the article that the goal is global domination, with perhaps a side associated goal of profiteering. And you look at the arms trade, which, you know, I think a lot of people in the United States have no idea that the majority of weapons sold to the Middle East are from the United States. That goal of profiteering off the arms trade almost seems to conflict at times with the goal of domination, in that the U.S. finds itself up against U.S. weapons. How big a factor in Middle East violence is the arming of people in the Middle East by U.S. weapons companies?
It's a major factor, you know, you don't have to necessarily even dig very deep to find this. So the New York Times had a report last April, I believe it was, that I think right in the headline went so far as to say that U.S. arms are directly responsible for fueling war in the region. Yeah, I think that it's the business of war in America is massive, and not just America, but in its allied states like Britain and Canada. I think that one can't necessarily assume that the U.S. goal is necessarily to create stable societies in the Middle East, in part because so much of the American elite depends upon the sales of weapons, and not just weapons, but all of the supporting infrastructure along with that. Can one even conceive of a scenario? I can't, where the United States says, okay, well, we recognize that, as the New York Times says, our pouring of weapons into the Middle East is fueling proxy wars and sectarian conflict, so therefore, let's stop doing that. That may be a logical conclusion to draw, but when you have company after company making billions upon billions for each of those wars, and these companies are extremely well connected in Washington, does anybody believe, I don't, that this is going to, you know, stop, right? I mean, it's not like the people in power in America don't know what's going on, right? They're not just bumbling along. If the New York Times can point it out, and if I can point it out, then, you know, frankly, intelligent people who are running the Pentagon, who are in the elite business class, are well aware of what's going on. They may not be nice or morally sound people, but they're not morons. Just to make one sort of quick point about how this works, and I mean, there's all kinds of cases that I explore in the article as far as what particular companies made off of were able to make in Iraq war profiteering, but also in more recent contracts that were issued for fighting ISIS. To see how this works, I'll just point to one example, which, according to the Daily Beast report, a company called AM General is supplying the Iraqi government, the U.S. allied Iraqi government, with 160 U.S.-built Humvees. General Dynamic is also selling the country millions of dollars worth of tank ammunition. And another company named SOS International has been awarded $400 million to provide services such as private security, again, in Iraq now, in the context of fighting ISIS. Well, this SOS International, its board of advisors include Paul Wolfowitz and Paul Butler, a former special assistant to Donald Rumsfeld. Paul Wolfowitz was Undersecretary of Defense under Rumsfeld in the Bush administration, for anybody who doesn't know that. So, I mean, to me, this illustrates the bipartisan imperialist consensus in American politics, that we have these hard right, these neoconservative right-wing figures associated with Rumsfeld, and in fact part of his Defense Department, and they're now working at companies profiting very directly off of a war being carried out by a Democratic administration.
Yeah, a number of them are working at universities spreading the ideology that supports this sort of institution. And I think the solution is going to come from, you know, canceling the profiteering. But that's not going to happen until we build a movement around the title of your other article that we've left very little time for, but I highly recommend people read, called Abolish the Military, where you look at a number of the negative impacts of militarism, including environmental and humanitarian, and including in particular, I think, what you start with, which is less discussed, I think, by many opponents of war, and that is how militarism abroad fuels racism and sexism in the United States. Can you explain that briefly?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's, at even the most superficial level, it's relatively obvious that, I mean, look at the countries that the American military has attacked since World War II. So whether we're talking about Korea, Indochina, Afghanistan, Iraq, all of these countries are populated. You could add Libya as well. All of these countries are populated by people of color, and in every war, a sort of new lexicon gains traction at home, which creates or contributes to racism against people in America from the communities that are originating from the countries being attacked overseas, or not even necessarily originating from or descending from them, but just maybe vaguely looking like they might have ancestry in, you know, the Middle East or in Southeast Asia or wherever. So, I mean, that's one angle, one aspect of the connection between U.S. imperialism and racism. I mean, there's also the fact that there's a major problem with neo-Nazism and white supremacy within the U.S. military, and some of the pieces I link to explore that in more detail.
We will, Greg, have to bring you back for another show to go into that topic, I'm afraid. We could go for hours, but we're out of time. I'll have the link up at talknationradio.org to both of these articles. Gregory Shupak, thank you very, very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you very much for having me.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. I'm traveling around the United States right now doing events with my new book, War is a Lie, second edition. I hope to see you. Find the schedule of events at warisalie.org. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
To Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, media are talking about the Panama Papers, the prodigious database leak from Panamanian law firm Mossack Fonseca that specializes in shell companies popular with those looking to hide money from the law. But to the extent that they treat it as shocking transgressions of the rich and powerful, the press are missing the point. Mossack Fonseca is not a unique operation. There's nothing special about Panama, and most of what's going on is, if not perfectly legal, legal anyway. We'll talk about using the Panama Papers to push for real change with investigative economist James Henry, author of The Blood Bankers, Tales from the Global Underground Economy. Also on the show, no U.S. apology for Hiroshima was many media's thumbnail of Secretary of State John Kerry's recent visit to one of the Japanese cities, with, of course, Nagasaki, where the U.S. killed more than 200,000 people with atomic bombs. The dominant Hiroshima narrative, lamentable but necessary, ultimately saved more than it killed, has remained remarkably unchanged, in good part because of U.S. media's defense and preservation of it. We discussed that narrative years ago with military and diplomatic historian Sanho Tree, now director of the Drug Policy Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. We'll bring you that interview later on. So, all of that's coming up, but first we'll take a quick look back at recent press. More than 400 people were arrested in a nonviolent sit-in on Capitol Hill April 11th, many having marched 150 miles from the Liberty Bell in Philadelphia. The protest, called Democracy Spring, is about ending the influence of big money in politics and ensuring free, fair elections through things like restoring the Voting Rights Act. The next day, another 85, mostly elderly people, were arrested, many chanting, "Democracy is not for sale. We're not too old to go to jail." Sounds like a story. And wait, yes, there it was in the Washington Post, in the Metro section, page B3, in the brief items, after the one about the 10-year-old boy hit by a car riding his bike. After the one about the man who got 2 years for tax evasions, yes, there it is, 150 or so words on the arrests, with the Post saying the organizing group seeks to prevent what it called voter suppression. As we tape the show on April 14th, the New York Times has yet to report in print on the demonstrations and mass arrests in the nation's capital. Research by The Intercept noted that cable news, with all of that time to fill, also took a pass. As of April 12th, CNN had done nothing. MSNBC mentioned the protests for about 12 seconds. Fox News gave them about 17 seconds. Later on in the day, CNN had a short item on its website. On Democracy Now!, organizer Kai Newkirk said the protests had a message for anyone running for office, that they have to decide, are you going to stand on the side of democracy and the side of the people, or on the side of big money and corruption? One has to wonder at Beltway reporters, self-proclaimed political junkies, profound lack of interest in following that line of inquiry. In the wake of North Carolina's new law banning transgender people from using restrooms that correspond with their gender identity in publicly run facilities and schools, you will have heard media asking what things like the cancellation of a Bruce Springsteen concert might mean for the state's business. You will have heard how Governor Pat McCrory now finds himself in the crossfire of a GOP civil war, as the Washington Post sympathetically put it. And you will have heard talk of a battle of freedoms. The Today Show on April 10th spoke of backlash against various religious freedom laws and explained, quote, at issue, the rights of the LGBT community pitted against those of people with religious objections, close quote. What you have heard little or none of is what Media Matters research fellow Carlos Massa called the question every reporter should be asking about transgender bathroom bans. Namely, how is the government supposed to figure out a person's biological sex? Mazza noted that media are amplifying right-wing myths about privacy and women's safety, even though the idea that men will pretend to be transgender to sneak into women's bathrooms has been thoroughly debunked by law enforcement and women's safety advocates across the country. But while they're busy walking through anti-LGBT talking points, media aren't asking Republican politicians to explain how they'll enforce laws that would require people to prove their biological sex at the bathroom door. The law says people must use facilities corresponding to the sex stated on a person's birth certificate. So people should carry their birth certificates with them at all times? You can't prove someone's transgender just by looking at them, but business owners and, hey, other bathroom goers should make snap judgments about who does and doesn't belong. Scarier still, Mazza notes that some states are looking at bills that would award damages to anyone who shared a bathroom with a transgender person. So, if media are indeed concerned with encouraging violations of privacy and safety, there are plenty of questions to ask. They just need to be sure they're asking the right people. And finally, Washington Post columnist Dana Milbank's April 8th piece on the presidential election was headlined, "The Reckless Versus the Responsible." You'll be unsurprised to learn that Bernie Sanders is among the reckless, in part because the McGuinness Group, the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, quote, calculates that Sanders would increase government spending to unimaginable levels, to as much as 35% of gross domestic product from the current 22%, close quote. What struck economist Dean Baker, who wrote about it for FAIR.org, is that word unimaginable. Most Western European governments have ratios of government spending to GDP of more than 40%. Some have ratios of more than 50%. So apparently Milbank finds the whole European continent unimaginable. But also, the increase in spending, offered as on its face some sort of nightmare, would be largely the result of the state diverting payments for health insurance to a government-run universal Medicare system. So what's being denounced is the idea that money now taken out of workers' paychecks to go to private insurers would instead go to the government. It would lead to hundreds of billions of dollars a year savings on administrative costs and insurance industry profits, but for Milbank, it's the height of irresponsibility. But then don't get too hung up on that responsibility idea, because Milbank has no problem with deficits that are too small, even if that means forcing millions of people to be out of work, their families consequently in or near poverty levels, and communities left to face things like exposure to lead poison in their drinking water, all because of whining from elites about how deficits must be avoided at all costs. You are listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. The worry about media reaction to the Panama Papers was that the press would treat revelations of the rich and powerful's ability to hide their wealth as somehow new or exotic. But we're moving beyond that now, with acknowledgement of, for instance, the U.S. role as a tax haven. A few have pointed to a Reuters piece from 2011 that dubbed Cheyenne, Wyoming, a little Cayman island on the Great Plains. And a piece in the Las Vegas Review-Journal noted that, as money launderers, Nevada's shell companies leave its casinos in the dust. But seeing it could just as easily have been the Delaware Papers is just the beginning of understanding the scope and the impact of global financial secrecy. And saying it should come as no shock doesn't mean that it isn't cause for outrage. We're joined now by investigative economist James Henry, author of The Blood Bankers, Tales from the Global Underground Economy. He's a senior fellow at the Columbia University Center for Sustainable International Investment and a senior advisor with the Tax Justice Network. Welcome back to Counterspin, James Henry.
Great to be here.
Well, let me ask you to say a bit about what this story is not, most importantly, about. It's not about Panama, but it's also, despite the headlines, not above all else about taxes, is it?
No, it's really a global industry that, of course, is raiding the treasuries of rich and poor countries all over the planet. and increasing inequality and raising tax burdens on the middle class and the poor. It's a huge industry. We estimate at least 21 to 32 trillion of offshore financial wealth, most of which is untaxed. And that's as of 2010. And it's grown since then. And there's another 5 trillion or 10 trillion of non-financial wealth that's parked through offshore companies like real estate or yachts or paintings. So we're talking about a huge phenomenon here. But the industry is not just about taxes, because in this case, the Panama Papers, we saw a lot of political officials, what we call kleptocrats, people who have become rich either in office or as a result of bribery after office. It's not clear exactly where it all comes from, but kleptocracy is a problem that's kind of independent of the tax dodging problem, because many of these dictators and autocrats are in countries that don't really have effective taxation. Their issue is they're stealing from the tax base. They're stealing from the treasury, or they're getting bribery. And more than 22, I think, heads of state and their families have been implicated in this so far. Putin's inner circle, who've been caught out in this, the entire Chinese Politburo, including relatives of the president of China. So this is a lot of behavior. But if you imagine the Star Wars bar scene, you have drug dealers and arms dealers and tax dodgers and kleptocrats and, you know, people engaged in financial chicanery. And many of our largest banks and multinationals sharing the same basic facilities, which are not, strictly speaking, just about taxes, but they're about financial secrecy. That's the shared facility.
Well, I wonder if you could talk about the extent to which it's illegal. There's a helpful piece by Brooke Harrington on The Atlantic that says, you know, anybody can set up a shell company in order to hide from taxes or child support or whatever, but you might get caught. You know, what rich people are paying for is the expertise that keeps them just on the right side of the law. So we shouldn't really be expecting many of the folks named in this Fonseca data dump to see the inside of a courtroom, not because they have the power to quash prosecution, though certainly some do, but because that's exactly what they've paid for.
Yes and no. I mean, the fact is a lot of this stuff clearly is illegal. And,
right.
As Mossack, we have a letter from one Mossack attorney to one of his clients, saying 95% of our clients are tax dodging. We have people on the UN sanctions list, U.S. Treasury sanctions against countries like North Korea. There are laws against public officials, you know, hiding wealth. Offshore, they're supposed to report that. And so a lot of that stuff is strictly illegal. The problem is, in many of these countries, we don't have courts that are independent and not for sale. So there's a real problem saying what is legal in China, for example, with respect to this kind of activity. It's sort of varies day by day. The legal issue, legality sort of fig leaf, is, I think, a bit of a canard. I mean, the problem is a lot of this behavior should be illegal. We're talking about a global system, you know, with all of this wealth. Mossack Fonseca, this one tiny Panama firm with $42 million of revenue, I mean, you know, Wall Street law firm does that every week. Credit Suisse, which is based in Zurich, has 2 million clients around the planet. They have $1 trillion of assets of management, and they're in 41 countries. So, you know, God knows what we'd find if we had a whistleblower from Credit Suisse. But this is a global industry. I mean, Mossack was dealing with 14,000 service providers, including 500 of the largest banks. I mean, banks like HSBC, the largest bank in the world, UBS, Credit Suisse, they're all sending them business. There's 1,800 tax lobbyists in Washington, you know, and they're not working for you or me. So the laws tend to be influenced by people who have much more representation than they do taxation.
Indeed. Well, just because something is legal or illegal, it still is a practice or a policy that has an impact and that has victims. And while the media have been talking about Iceland's prime minister as being a victim, there are other people who are saying, well, you know, let's really talk about
working and middle-class people who pay taxes, for example, as victims, or those who rely on the public works and benefits that are being starved. There was a piece by, you know, talking about women in particular as victims of this. What can you tell us about the real harm done to people and to countries?
Well, first of all, we are facilitating all of these particular kinds of crime, and if the light is shined on them, they won't sleep as well. I think the most important fact about this is that the global haven industry that we've allowed to grow up since the 1970s is really a direct threat to democratic government and the rule of law. To some extent, it's because it allows bad actors to conceal wealth, some terrorists and so forth. But the real thing is that if you have political leaders and a political class that's basically not responsible to their citizens and is hiding wealth offshore and, you know, free to engage in corruption, they're not going to be responsible to the people who elected them. They're going to be doing deals on the side, not only to enrich themselves, but to extend their rule. And so it really undermines democracy. Anybody concerned about representative democracy and the rule of law, I think, should be concerned about this. It is true that the U.S. has been a tax haven of sorts. I first wrote my piece called The U.S. is a Tax Haven in the Washington Post in February 1989. This is an old story.
Well, let me just ask you finally, I can get a little cynical about journalists' emphasis on this as primarily a feat of journalism. You know, I worry that it can be a kind of hall of mirrors where we forget to notice if the world changes as a result of the latest blockbuster, award-winning, whatever. But it is meaningful that this came from reporters and not from the government regulators ostensibly tasked with it. But I just wonder, finally, now that the sort of journalistic jets are open, where would you like to point reporters? Where would you like to encourage them to investigate and maybe direct them away from in terms of moving the story forward?
I think there's always a threat of a kind of a revelation fatigue in this kind of situation, the focus on names and prominent people and all that, as opposed to the institutions that are involved. From my standpoint, every decade since the 70s, when I first started writing about the offshore haven industry, in a case called the Castle Bank and Trust case, which involved U.S. citizens investing in the Bahamas, every decade we've had scandals involving the offshore haven industry. There's increasing scandals from BCCI and Noriega, Salinas money, onto the Swiss banks in the last 5 years. And then finally this thing. So I'm about to say, you know, look, I'm sick of this subject. If you can't finally have a policy breakthrough, governments have known about this for literally for decades and done nothing. I mean, it can't be just a question of reality TV. We have to turn this into reform. So I would invite journalists to, I mean, a lot of young journalists are learning for the first time about this industry, and it's great. Now they need to focus on the really big players in the industry, like banks, U.S. banks that are involved in global private banking, and, you know, the fact that there are other critical havens like the Cayman Islands that are, you know, host to most of the world's hedge funds. There's just plenty of work to be done on all kinds of aspects of this story. We just, for example, found that Geneva freeports are being used as a parking lot for Picasso paintings by the hundreds by way of offshore companies that are holding them in their names. And they're being used to launder money. I mean, they're being swapped back and forth. If you have $50 million to launder, you know, well, you know, I got it from Picasso. I sold a Picasso. What a wonderful device. So the art market is being affected by this. There are just tons of stories like that that are crying out for more detailed investigation. What this story shows is the power of, in this case, more than 300 journalists who have gotten together across the planet and sort of carved it up and worked together. And that's a real role model for future journalist efforts.
We've been speaking with James Henry. You can find his article, Taxing Tax Havens, How to Respond to the Panama Papers, on foreignaffairs.com. James Henry, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
B Media reports noted that Secretary of State John Kerry was the highest-ranking sitting U.S. official to visit the war memorial in Hiroshima. U.S. ambassadors have shown their respects, and Jimmy Carter went there when he was out of office. But from non-blame-assigning references to one of the most destructive acts of World War II, as a New York Times article had it, to an obliviously ethnocentric focus on how these commemorations have, as the Times said, long-troubled American diplomats, nothing suggests that U.S. media find much to grapple with. And why would they, when, as the paper of record tells us, quote, a majority of Americans have long believed that the bombings were necessary to force Japan's surrender and to spare American lives, close quote. That's why any hint that the U.S. was apologizing could prove highly damaging politically. Well, corporate media have shown little interest in probing the official history on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Did you know, for example, that on August 9, 1945, Harry Truman declared falsely in a radio address, quote, the world will note that the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, a military base. That was because we wished in this first attack to avoid, insofar as possible, the killing of civilians, close quote. On the 50th anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in August of 1995, Counterspin spoke with military and diplomatic historian Sanho Tree, who had just collaborated with Gar Alperovitz on The Decision to Use the Atomic Bomb and the Architecture of an American Myth. Sanho Tree is today the director of the Drug Policy Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. We asked, first of all, about the key issues U.S. media were discussing just prior to the bombing.
First was the rapid deterioration of the Japanese war economy and military situation, that their navy was at the bottom of the sea, her air force was non-existent, and that she was reduced to crashing kamikaze planes into ships, and this was their fighters were gone. The American planes were going over Japan unopposed. Another point was unconditional surrender, that the Allied war aim of unconditional surrender was interpreted by the Japanese to mean the execution of the emperor, that he would be prosecuted and perhaps hung as a war criminal. And the Japanese regarded him as a deity. And all of Truman's advisors advised him, you know, you've got to tell them to keep the emperor or they'll keep on fighting forever. A third point was the Russian entry into the war. The Soviet Union was neutral throughout this period and was going to declare a war on Japan in mid-August by common agreement with the United States and Great Britain. This was a secret agreement made at Yalta. And the fourth was the peace feelers that were breaking out all over Europe and also in the Soviet Union, that the Japanese were trying to reach American emissaries to explain to them what terms they wanted for surrender. And the one term that always came up was the retention of the emperor.
Everything changed, though, after the bomb was dropped, including in the media.
Throughout the media, there was this pretty much a euphoria. Oh, thank God, the war is over. Many attribute this to the bomb, even though their own newspapers and their own magazines had reported that, you know, the Japanese were already defeated and were seeking peace. There are a few critics, people of conscience, the religious community, continue to speak out. By and large, the mass media don't speak out because they would essentially have to call the president a liar and challenge his official rationale. And the people who do speak out, it's interesting, are the conservatives. The first decade and a half, up until the 1960s, it's the conservatives in the right wing that keep up the steady drumbeat saying that Hiroshima was not necessary. And this is completely forgotten about today. The National Review, for instance, or Human Events, or a far-right-wing journal called The Freeman. These were all journals that were saying that this was an atrocity, that this was a, and the National Review headline was Hiroshima, an assault on a beaten foe. This is 1958, William F. Buckley's journal. And of course, nowadays Buckley takes a completely different position. Says they were necessary.
Counterspin asked if it wasn't strange that contemporary complaints about a Smithsonian exhibit of the Enola Gay being too critical of the United States, for example, weren't labeling revisionist what had actually been an open position in the U.S. media at the time.
Absolutely. For instance, the Washington Post kept up the steady drumbeat throughout the spring and summer 1945, saying you must change the terms of surrender. And every other day, it seemed that they were having a different editorial, trying to drive home this point that the emperor must be spared, that, you know, that's the only way to get a surrender out of Japan. And, of course, now the Washington Post ridicules all this stuff as revisionist. This is their own position. They were, in fact, so proud of their editorials, they published a booklet around 1946, and it was called Psychological Warfare, the special weapon that had Japan defeated and ready to yield 13 days before the atomic bombs were dropped. They were so proud of their role back then, and now they dismiss all of this as revisionist.
We asked Treed to describe the Washington Post's coverage of the controversy at the Smithsonian about the display of the Enola Gay.
The Washington Post, for instance, Ken Ringel, one of their key reporters on this beat, reproduced an erroneous quote in the Wall Street Journal. And this is in August of 1994, which touched off the firestorm in Washington. And the quote was attributed to the curators of the exhibit. And the quote read, it was describing the kamikaze pilots, and it said, you know, quote, these youths, their bodies overflowing with life, unquote. And, of course, this was actually, the caption said this was said by another kamikaze pilot describing his comrades. And this was a Japanese view. But the Wall Street Journal attributed this to the curators. Ringel repeated it the next day in the newspaper in the Washington Post, and it becomes this political football at that point. And that this suddenly it blows up in everyone's faces, and everyone goes running for cover. You will not see in the exhibit, for instance, quotes by General Eisenhower or Admiral Leahy, who was the chief of staff of the president and presiding officer of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Both of them had tremendously powerful quotes where they talk about how they didn't think it was necessary and advise so. And they called it, you know, Leahy calls it a barbarous weapon. And it was of no material assistance in our war against Japan. The Japanese were already defeated and ready to surrender. That's gone.
That was Sanho Tree discussing media coverage of the U.S. bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki on Counterspin in 1995. And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
With what we know about climate change, should anyone add another child into that future? We'll get two points of view from women who write about it. Then we hear recent science proving extreme rainfall events and extreme drought will continue and get worse as the planet warms. I'm Alex Smith. Buckle up and off we go in this week's Radio EcoShock. When we talk about the conversation, it is usually that far too late talk about sex by parents with their kids who already know all that. Today we are going to relabel the conversation a little bit. It's an inner talk that you have with yourself and maybe a careful dialogue you could share with close friends. And the question is touchy and it's heavy. Knowing the climate is going to be wrecked with huge consequences for humans and for nature, should I bring a child into that world? Or as journalist Madeline Ostrander puts it, how do you decide to have a baby when climate change is remaking life on Earth? That's the title of her latest article in The Nation magazine. Ostrander is also a contributing editor at Yes magazine. Madeline, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
All right. Now, to talk about this, Madeline, I find that I have to bring up my own thoughts and worries. Do you find this subject hits deep with some people?
It does, particularly a certain segment of people, I would say. Of course, people who are in their childbearing years. And, you know, the Yale Project on Climate Communication has divided particularly the American public into kind of six groups in terms of their positions on climate change. And there's a group called the Alarmed, which is about 13% of Americans. And these are the people who take climate change most seriously and know the most about it. And I would say that this conversation is probably hits the hardest for that group of people.
I guess others would simply brush off any mention of climate change or fears for their kids' future. Have you encountered that?
I have encountered that some people really aren't thinking about it. I don't know whether they brush it off or not. It's just that people go about their lives and they're aware of climate change, but it's not real for them. And I think there's a segment of people for whom it is somewhat real and a segment of people for whom it's very real. And for that latter category, I would say that those are the people who are most concerned about how climate change is going to affect their families.
And I noticed early in your article you talk about Paul and Ann Ehrlich's dire predictions in the 1970s. I admire both of them. I've interviewed Paul Ehrlich, but I have to say their future of horror and famine didn't come true, at least not yet. Is that a bad example?
Well, I brought out that example because I think that the conversation that Paul Ehrlich started in the 70s still informs how particularly environmentalists talk about the question of having children. So when people talk about the ethics of having children, and then actually it's not just environmentalists. I mean, people will talk about overpopulation. People will talk about whether or not it's morally right to add another child to the world because of the number of people who are already on the planet. I think that the conversation is shifting a little bit. I think even among population advocates, it's shifting somewhat so that groups like Population Connection, which is the new name of the organization Ehrlich founded, Zero Population Growth, now talk about population in a systemic way, and they talk about human rights and women's rights and bringing health care to people and allowing people to have more choices. And that turns out to solve a large chunk of the question of having too many people. And I think what now we have to wrestle with is how we're actually living on the planet and how the ways that we're living on the planet are contributing to climate change. So my article was an effort to try to shift that conversation to some degree or to acknowledge that there are new pieces of it that we need to talk about.
What are you picturing in the climate-changed future that brings you such serious doubts?
Well, as a journalist, I spend a fair bit of time talking with scientists because I write about these issues on a regular basis. And scientists are doing a couple of things. One is that they're more and more using high emission scenarios because that's, as a society, what we've been doing. So scientists are now often looking at the worst case scenarios, the most extreme scenarios for what could happen in the world. They're also getting more and more precise about the kinds of predictions they can make and the ways that they can paint a dire and fairly specific picture of the possible impacts that we could have happen. So, for instance, there was a paper a year ago about mega droughts, droughts lasting several decades across the Southwest and California, that has really serious implications for water shortages in that part of the world, which, of course, has serious implications for agriculture and our ability to feed ourselves. And there was another report by the New York City Panel on Climate Change saying that we could have Superstorm Sandy-style flooding in New York City on a regular basis by 2050. And when you think about 2050, any kid who's born now is just going to be in their 30s. So that means that your life could be marked by these extreme events, and that's a frightening thought for me, and it makes me think about what kind of future could I promise to anyone that I might bring into the world.
Madeline, our parents and grandparents went through the Great Depression and then World War II, where 60 million people died. Is the climate future worse than that?
I guess I would say that I think that the climate crisis is unprecedented in human experience. I think that when you talk to scientists, they will tell you that the kinds of scenarios that we could see would be unprecedented in terms of what humans have been able to deal with and experience. And so if we don't address the issue now, we may not be able to adjust and adapt effectively. We may not be able to thrive and survive. And so I think that it is a different scenario, and it requires different thinking than even a situation in which you're confronting something like major conflict or warfare.
I totally agree. I mean, one of the scariest aspects of climate change is that we have nothing in the past to compare it to. I just spoke to a scientist who said, well, going back 66 million years, we've never had such a fast injection of so much greenhouse gas in such a short time. Nobody knows what's going to happen, and that's another big worry.
Right, exactly. So, I mean, when you're thinking about becoming a parent, you have to make decisions now without knowing what the future is going to look like for you or for your kid, and that's really scary. And to some extent, I mean, that's life. You always have to make decisions not knowing what the future will look like. But I think you don't always have to make decisions with this big shadow of these very troubling scientific predictions hanging over your potential life. And it makes it difficult to think about what is the right thing to do.
I find we tend to make a lot of choices based on our memories. And if you could give me just a minute to share mine, I think that develops into a sort of second question. So beyond the personal decision to have a child, I'm thinking about when I was growing up. I did have children, incidentally, and they revolutionized my life. Now I'm worried about my grandkid. But most Americans and Europeans never experienced what I had as far as nature. I mean, there were empty lots. It was safe to go play in them all day without adults watching. There were woods within walking distance. We went to the lake all summer. I feel like I'm a sibling with nature, but now with people in big cities, millions and millions more in big cities, they're never going to experience that. So my question is, perhaps we could say even without climate change, there are reasons not to have children in this civilization at this time. How do you feel about that?
I think there's been this concern for a long time. When I wrote this article, I did some research and I looked up some of the groups, environmental and population groups of the 70s. And people said, in a way, they said similar things. They said, I don't know whether it's reasonable to bring a child into this world, given everything that's wrong with it. There are also reasons to have children. One thing I think is that it's important to recognize how personal and deep and difficult this choice is for everyone, and to respect the choices that individual families make and give them the space to reflect on these kinds of issues. I think that in the best scenarios, having children gives people a connection to the world and to the future and a sense of a stake in what happens in the world and a reason to be passionate and get involved and to have love and joy and all of the things that are part of being a human being. There are certainly other ways to do that, and there are many reasons why. Yeah, sure, having a kid might give people pause.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Madeline Ostrander. She's a contributing editor at Yes Magazine and a writer for The Nation. We're talking about the big question, should we bring another child into a world when the future is threatened by climate disruption? There are a few pockets of natural sanity left in all countries, and I'm thinking that women from Beijing to Berlin are asking themselves the question, is this the place to have a baby? It's sort of a where question. I wonder if that figures into this conversation as well.
I mean, I can't really speak for, you know, women around the world, of course. I can talk about how in the article that I wrote, I attended these events that are being organized by a new group that started up out of the East Coast. It's called Conceivable Future. And there are groups of women and men getting together and talking about these very issues that we're talking about on the show. And you will hear in those rooms a very open and compassionate conversation, all different kinds of perspectives about what people feel, you know, how they feel they should make this decision. I heard a mother who was pregnant with her second child and had a toddler at home talk about how she wanted to think about how to teach her kids the kinds of skills that they might need to confront a lot of uncertainty and to confront the difficulties that the world might present them. And she had gone into that process and that decision very thoughtfully. I heard other people say that they weren't sure if they wanted to have children. I heard people wrestling with the decision. I heard people who said that they had actively decided not to. I've also heard from people both before and after writing the article talking about how they made a choice to adopt, or they made a choice to be part of helping raise children in a different way, maybe looking after godchildren or, you know, being involved in raising the next generation in a lot of ways. So I think there's a big diversity in the kinds of choices people can make about this. I think what's new is that people are starting to have this thoughtful conversation about what the future of the world looks like because of climate change and how might that affect their childbearing choices.
Do you think, given that politics is currently almost in a state of denial, at least in one party, about climate change, and the mainstream media just blathers on about everything else, that this conversation is being driven underground, that it's kind of unpolite to mention it at dinner or at parties or at work or at school or anywhere?
It's definitely impolite to try to have this conversation. It's a really difficult conversation. One of the things I reflected about in the article that was in The Nation is that people would sort of whisper this conversation to me for a few years anyway. People I knew would say, I see what's happening with climate change and it makes me not want to have children. And then maybe they would still have children, but they wouldn't talk about their decision-making process. People would sort of murmur this idea to me and then they would change the subject quickly because it's an uncomfortable and scary and difficult and very personal thought. I don't know if it's being driven underground by the political context. I think it's just a set of topics that we're not very comfortable talking about. But I think that it's a really important conversation because when you talk about climate change, not in terms of some abstract idea about future generations, but in terms of my own children and what kind of lives are they going to have, it becomes much more deeply personal. And when we start asking those kinds of hard questions, we begin to take the problem more seriously. And my hope is that having that conversation doesn't send it underground, but actually brings things up to the surface that people haven't been talking about yet.
And we know that just a century ago, there really was not much choice for a woman and very little for men either. It was part of human duty to have children. And it's still that way for billions of people in many parts of the world. So it's going to be a while before this becomes a global conversation.
Sure, of course. Even in the United States, there are women who don't have a lot of access to things like contraception and healthcare. And so there are many people who don't have the choice about whether to have children. They have a baby and then they have to think about how they're going to manage. There's ways in which this is a somewhat new situation that we have a substantial number of women in Western and developed countries who do have the ability to make this a choice. And that's part of what makes this conversation and this moment different as well. Millennials in the United States actually have a lower fertility rate than any previous generation in American history. And a lot of that is because of economic reasons. But it signals this shift in the ways that people are making this decision, I think.
And I just read that in the United States today, almost half the babies were born unintended. So a conversation and the decision never took place.
Right. Well, I think part of the conversation as well is not just how do you make this decision, but also once you have children, how do you think about what their future is going to be like and how do you act as a parent? And so those two conversations become bundled together in this discussion about climate change and the future and how are we a part of it?
Madeline, have you seen any poll or survey or research to indicate how many women or what percentage of women are doubting the future enough to reconsider having children?
I looked for that information, but I think that it's not a question that's necessarily on the radar yet of people who do polls. So I think that there's data out there about who's having children, and there's some data about how certain kinds of factors like the economy in particular might be influencing their views about the world. But the environment, I feel like we don't really even have the right language for talking about these questions that we're raising, you know, on this show right now. I think we're just starting this conversation. How does the fate of the world affect your decisions about having children? So no, not yet.
Well, it is the start of a conversation, but millions more people are learning about climate disruption all the time, despite the Koch brothers. And that means that what is a minority now may be the cutting edge. Who knows who could define a whole new movement or a current among human beings, Do you think that can happen?
Yeah, I think that one thing I've noticed since I wrote the article, you know, which was a, I admit, it was, we've talked about impolite conversations. I mean, it's a frightening thing in a way to put out a personal statement like that, and it's not necessarily what I even typically write. But I've had a big response, particularly from young women. I would say probably most of the responses come from women under 35, but even women in their 20s who are wrestling with these questions and felt like they weren't seeing anyone actually talk about them in a public way. So I do think that this is on the cutting edge, and I do think that people who are younger, who grew up with hearing about climate change their whole lives, have a different perspective on it than other people. And I hope that the conversation will keep going and will grow.
Where do men fit into all this?
Well, certainly men do fit into it. I mean, people make decisions as couples. And there were a number of men at, for instance, these events that I talked about where people were getting together and having these conversations about climate change. For some men, it seemed to be still a little bit more of an intellectual conversation than an emotional one. But I think when you're in the position of beginning to actually talk more seriously about having a child, it becomes more emotional and more personal and deeper. So, yeah, I mean, men are definitely part of the conversation. I think as a feminist, I mean, I guess I would say that the ultimate decision about whether you have a child or not should rest with women, but I think men are part of that discussion.
For sure. And I was wondering if you have any suggestions for our listeners on how we could start up these uncomfortable conversations.
Yeah, so one of the organizations that I profiled in my article is a new organization called Conceivable Future, and they are starting these conversations all over the country. They host events in different cities like Los Angeles and Chicago and New York and Providence. So, you know, one thing to do would be to try to connect with them. But I think you don't necessarily need an official format to have a conversation like this. I think just creating some kind of safe space where people feel comfortable talking openly about this issue and know that they're not going to be judged. That was the premise of the events I went to. So I think it's possible to start this conversation, and I think it's important. And I think what I've discovered is that people are actually longing to have this conversation.
Well, we have listeners in small towns in Ohio and Kansas. Are there online resources that they can find?
Sure. The organization that I was just mentioning is called Conceivable Future. And if you Google that, you will find their website. There are other organizations for parents and children. There is a Northwest-based organization that is actually currently in the middle of filing a lawsuit against the federal government because they say that we have not done enough as a nation to safeguard the future of young people. There are lots of resources across the country for parents wanting to educate their children. There's also the organization Population Connection has a project called Population Education, and they have conversations in schools and with children about the issue of population and questions to do with having a child. So that's another resource.
Okay, as we finish up, is there any other parting advice you'd like to leave with us?
I think I would just say that I think that this is a really important conversation for people to begin having with one another. I think it's important to think, to be real about how climate change might affect your family, how it might affect the people that you love, how that might influence the decisions that you make. I think it's important to recognize that the predictions for climate change are coming within our lifetimes and could have huge implications on future generations. And I think once we take that seriously, I hope that it starts to transform the whole conversation we have about climate change and make it more possible to think in more personal ways about what it means and how do we make the kinds of changes that are necessary.
We have been talking with Madeline Ostrander. She's a contributing editor at Yes Magazine and contributing writer for The Nation magazine, where she published the seminal article, How Do You Decide to Have a Baby When Climate Change is Remaking Life on Earth? Of course, you can find more, including reader comments, at thenation.com or try the links in my own show blog at ecoshock.info. Madeline, thank you so much for getting this conversation going.
Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Later in this show, scientist Marcus Donat explains his latest paper on extreme precipitation in a hotter world. The old saying about the circus, there's a sucker born every minute. But hundreds of new humans are born every minute as the human population continues to multiply. Many will be Western-style super consumers, the ones who drain resources from all over the world and fill the skies with greenhouse gases. If we can't control that urge, a major climate catastrophe may do it for us. Alicia Graves has one of the answers we need. She calls it green sex, do it for the climate. We'll find out what that means. Alicia has a master's in public health from the University of California. She's co-founded and leads a group called the OASIS Initiative, which stands for Organizing to Advance Solutions in the Sahel. The Sahel is that band of desert countries in North Africa where population is exploding in the face of poverty. But as we'll learn, they are not the big climate problem. Alicia Graves is also a research fellow for Project Drawdown, a group of scientists and other experts working to create a livable climate future. Alicia, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much.
Now, you do realize that a lot of people don't even want to hear about this subject at all. Is it because right-wing men, especially in the United States, have poisoned it with religious objections and paranoia? What is the problem? Why are people shying away from talking about population?
That's a very good question. I think what happened is that in the 60s and 70s, as some of the listeners will know, there was a lot of talk about a population explosion. There was a book by Paul Ehrlich that got a lot of attention to the issue. And I guess because his projections didn't pan out as quickly as he expected, people have dismissed it. Of course, there have been coercive population programs in many parts of the world, which have led people to be a bit repulsed by the idea. And actually, in my writing and when I get a chance to speak to people like today, I want to reinforce the fact that it's not so much about population control. It's just meeting women's basic needs to separate sex from childbearing.
Okay, now to hear some environmental groups tell it, all we have to do is install solar energy and drive electric cars, problem solved. Alicia, can we really tackle the climate issue without talking about population?
No, I don't think we can. I think we have to recognize that each one of us has a direct and multiplying effect on all sorts of environmental issues, resource usage for sure, but also emissions and climate. We have to recognize that that's part of the picture. And in doing so, we should also recognize that it doesn't mean telling women what to do. It's about giving us what we want.
And our other instant mental defense, it seems to me, is to tell ourselves it's those billions of peasants over there somewhere who are responsible for population impact. What's wrong with that idea?
Well, like you said in your opening, it's a silly idea because people in the poorest parts of the world, yes, 99% of population growth in this century is happening in less developed countries. So that is a major demographic story. But these are not the people who will be high emitters. We know that U.S. has some of the world's highest emission rates, and it's also true that almost one in two pregnancies in our country and in the U.S. are unintended. By unintended pregnancy, I mean women who said they did not intend or mean to get pregnant at that time, or some of them ever again, but they do have a pregnancy. So there's an enormous opportunity to meet women's basic needs for reproductive health services.
You know, when I read that in your article, it kind of blew my mind. I thought, well, look, we're in the age of the birth control pill and all sorts of ways, condoms, whatever. How is it possible that still almost half the babies in the United States are unplanned?
Yeah, it is very surprising. I think something to take into account is that most women in the U.S. want to have, on average, 2 children. So to achieve that, let's just take an average woman, will spend about 5 years either trying to get pregnant or lactating, in which case she's not really eligible to get pregnant. And then she'll spend another 30 years trying to avoid getting pregnant. And so it's a very long time to use consistently and correctly without fail
contraception. And there are technological, you know, malfunctions, there's human error. And so that also needs to be backed up with access to safe abortion, timely and safe abortion, which in light of the current political climate, we have to look very carefully at the views of our potential next president are. I'm scared about the idea of Ted Cruz, for example, because he wants to deny women rights to these basic reproductive health services.
Yep, pretty scary step backwards if that happens. Now, I wish you would take just a little time to explain this formula called IPAT, how it works and why it matters. Tell us about that, please, Alicia.
Thanks, Alex. Yes, I will. I equals P times A times T is a very important equation and pretty straightforward. It was published by Paul Ehrlich and John Holdren, who's the science advisor to the current president. It stands for impact on the environment equals population times affluence times technology. And I think affluence is, in this case, it's our ability to consume. So if we think about it in terms of climate, for example, we know that consumption, especially use of electricity, has, again, a multiplying effect. And T is technology. Now, I've seen another version of this where T, the technology, can actually reduce our impact on the environment. And we're seeing this more and more with climate solutions.
Now, conservatives, who we talked about, who are sometimes against women's control over reproduction, also claim to be concerned about spending, about fiscal responsibility. What are the high-cost ways to reduce greenhouse gases versus a low-cost approach?
I can't go too much into the details because I'm focused on two approaches. Let me tell you about these. Family planning is a very low-cost approach. The Guttmacher Institute estimates it's about $6 to $10 per user of family planning per year. So it's a very low-cost approach by allowing women to achieve her family size or avoiding an unintended pregnancy. Another low-cost, very, very high payoff approach is by educating girls. And education, I hope you'll agree, is a basic human right. It's also essential for development. And yet secondary school education, especially for adolescent girls in poor parts of the world, the rates are abysmal. And so this is something that has, in addition to upholding basic rights, allowing women to have more control over her future, it also has a climate payoff. Because by keeping girls in school, it helps delay their marriage and delay their childbearing. It makes it more likely that they'll use family planning in the future and be able to negotiate that with their partner. I mean, there's even evidence to show that women who go to secondary school tend to have better farming outcomes, better crop yields, et cetera. So that's another example. But one other thing I would say in response to your question is, for any listeners who are interested in these different climate solutions, visit the Project Drawdown site. The solutions are more surprising and more diverse than we think, and they're looking at the top 100 solutions that can be scaled up in the coming decades to draw down the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, not just stabilize them just under the 2 degrees Celsius dangerous cutoff that's been identified.
So if I understand your writing, we make a fundamental change in greenhouse gases by reexamining our attitude towards sex. So what do you mean when you say green sex?
Yeah, I thought that was a pretty a clever name for it. But as I said at the beginning, I really just mean allowing women to separate sex from childbearing. And for many of us, we take this for granted, but in parts of the world and in communities in developed countries like the U.S., there are plenty of women who aren't able to do this for various barriers, some of them political and some of them more personal. So I just mean allowing each woman to choose her family size and not let it be something that happens to her.
Well, men are definitely involved because I think in many parts of the world and in the United States, there are men who have been brought up to believe or do believe that the more kids they have, the more manly they are.
Yes, Alex, that is true. And there's the old expression, it takes two to tango. In parts of the world, there's definitely a lot of respect that's garnered on people who have large families. That's something that needs to be recognized. But there are also plenty of men who say that they, you know, either had desire to wait longer before they had a kid or to stop having them altogether, and yet they find themselves with a partner who's pregnant. So I think we should focus on those people who have a need today and make sure that all of those needs are met. Around the world, there are about 220 million women who say they want to stop or space their next pregnancy but aren't using family planning. And so there's a huge opportunity there to reach those women and have tremendous benefits for her personally and her taking control of her life, also her health, her family's health, and of course, like we started with, the climate.
So, Alicia, to be clear, are you telling men and women to stop having children because the climate future is so terrible?
No, I'm not. I have two children myself, and I understand their immense value. And I think actually that they will be the ones to really bring the creativity and the imagination to help solve the climate crisis. I'm telling men and women to recognize that there is a need for family planning. It needs to be put back onto the agenda. We don't have to be afraid to talk about the relationship between population and the environment. We need to look at countries that have had successful voluntary family plannings where family size has fallen very rapidly. And they're around the world. It's Iran, Thailand, Rwanda, for example. These are countries, when it's prioritized, families tend to choose to have fewer children. Couples choose to have smaller families. And so this needs to be on the international agenda.
You know, I think Iran is such a stimulating example because there we have a Muslim country and people have this prototype, preconception that a Muslim country, they won't have family planning. So what do you know what happened in Iran that made it work there?
I know a little bit about it. They realized that population was growing very fast and that it was detrimental to the country's development. And they chose to invest time and money, of course, in making sure that each couple could reach their desired family size. One of the things that they did was put in place mandatory couples counseling before marriage. And I think in the counseling, they talked about many things, but of course, they talked about reproduction, how babies are made, and how to prevent pregnancies in the case that the couple chose to. So if this is something systematic, again, voluntary, backed up with good access to health services, it's not enough to know about how to prevent pregnancy. You need to have the technology, the contraceptives, either modern or there are traditional methods as well in order to do that. It's some people focus so much on getting the information out about avoiding pregnancy, but are afraid to then back that up with good access to contraceptives. You need both, of course.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, talking with American public health expert Alicia Graves about green sex. Alicia, what is the situation in the Sahel where your organization Oasis Initiative works?
Yes, Oasis, as you mentioned, is a project of the University of California, Berkeley. I started it with my colleague Malcolm Potts a few years ago. We are focused on the Sahel region. It's an ecological zone just south of the Sahara Desert. It's a transition zone that stretches across the widest part of Africa. And it really is going to be, it already is, ground zero for climate effects, man-made climate effects on human health. The region has suffered severe droughts and famines since the 70s into the 80s. Even today, at the heart of the region, in a country called Niger, nearly half of children are stunted. They're not growing to their physical or cognitive potential because of malnutrition. We're bringing a multidisciplinary approach to looking at what can we do, what will work, especially for girls and women in this region in order to reach a place of true development. And we have partners in the region, other universities. We're focused on really practical approaches to girls and women's empowerment, especially how to keep girls in secondary school or at least give them some basic life skills. And we're also looking at how to reach women with family planning, which is kind of the last frontier in the field of family planning. It has some of, Niger has the world's highest fertility rates, very large desired family sizes. And yet there are about 1.5 times as many women who want access to contraceptives but aren't using them as there are women who are using them. So even in this very difficult place to work, there are tremendous opportunities to help women meet basic needs for family planning and for taking control of their lives.
And are people there beginning to get cars and motor scooters and things that will emit more greenhouse gases, or are they merely set up in the place where our greenhouse gases are going to have the most impact?
That's a good question. I think most of the least developed countries are really not on a path towards great economic development. Part of the story is because their populations are growing so rapidly that the GDP, the per capita economic growth, is not able to keep up with the population. I think you make a good point. A lot of the lesser developed countries are on a path towards development, and they will be emitting more greenhouse gases in the future. But I think really the story for the least developed countries, unfortunately, is that unless some urgent investment and action is taken in the very near future, they'll be more victims of climate change than they will be contributing to it via, you know, all of these lovely luxuries that most of your listeners are privy to, like motorbikes and cars, electricity at the home, et cetera. Bill and Melinda Gates, in their most recent annual letter, actually, Bill talks about what a common good energy is, and he makes a very good case for investing in green energy and really approaching it in a much more creative, much more scalable way. Because it's not something, of course, we don't want to deny this to anybody. It's key to our development.
Of course, if drought continues to hit that part of Africa, followed by floods, as it so often is, we may see more climate refugees. We're already seeing a lot of North Africans are headed to Europe as economic refugees, you can call them, but I would call some of them climate refugees. That'll change the picture because then they'll want to live like Europeans.
Yes, the refugees from Syria last summer, which of course is still continuing, but it was in the news a lot last summer, it got a lot of attention. And what people need to know is that this is just sort of the tip of the iceberg. The UN projects that about 60 million people will move out of the desertified areas, the places in Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, that are becoming more desert-like because it's harder to live there. About 60 million people moving out of those regions by 2020, which is a huge number. It doesn't mean that all of them are going to Europe. They could be relocating in other parts of sub-Saharan Africa. But these are very vulnerable populations that need our attention and really forethought. This is just at the cusp, and there are some things that can be done now, like heavy, heavy investments in adolescent girls' education, voluntary family planning, and, of course, planning for migration. So, yeah, migration is a big part of the story.
Now, we have the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. We had the recent Paris climate talks. Do these international bodies take the population angle seriously, or are they afraid to talk about it?
Alex, that's a very good question, and I don't know the answer. There's a great report it's the Climate and Health report from the last series of IPCC reports, and it recognizes reproductive health services, including modern family planning, as having the potential for climate mitigation to reduce carbon emissions. It talks about co-benefits for human health and the climate. So there are some people in these institutions that definitely do recognize it, but oftentimes I read reports that really focus on how rapid population growth is a challenge. There is a recent World Bank report about climate impact amongst poor families in poor parts of the world, and they cited rapid population growth, I think, 10 times as a contributing factor. But then in 70 pages of recommendations, they didn't go on to recommend investment in voluntary family planning. So some people either don't understand the relationship between population and environment, but I think more often they don't recognize that something can be done that upholds women's basic human rights and has positive effects on the environment.
And you've linked to a paper titled Reproduction and the Carbon Legacies of Individuals. It's by Paul Murtaugh and Michael Schlacks. What does that contribute to this conversation?
Oh, that's a very interesting analysis that looks at, yes, as you say, the carbon legacy, the effects, the carbon effects of each child that a couple has. And I forget exactly how they do their analysis, but of course, each child has his or her own carbon footprint, but then they have the likelihood that they will again have a child. So it's like a multi-generational type analysis to look at the carbon effects. And the takeaway is that having an additional child will have, let me put this positively because it is a positive story, that averting an unintended pregnancy will have greater benefits for reducing greenhouse gases than all of the other things that we can do combined. This is in the case of high-consuming couples. Averting an unintended pregnancy will have greater benefits than buying a Prius and going solar electricity for the house, et cetera. So I think it's a really good paper. I'm glad you brought that up.
So wrapping this up for our listeners, I'm sure we're all wondering, how do we approach this? How do we talk to other people about this subject? Do you have any ideas for conversation starters?
I think that we don't have to be afraid about making the connections between population and the environment. You can be concerned about the environment and population's effects on it, and at the same time want to uphold a woman's rights to have a family. Because we have about 40 years of data from around the world showing that when governments prioritize and invest in voluntary family planning, family size falls. That's the conversation opener. We need to get population back on the world agenda.
Do you have any websites, a Facebook page, or a Twitter feed that you'd like to pass on to our listeners?
Yes, I would. Please look at our website, oasisinitiative.berkeley.edu. We are looking for partners, and we are also have a Friends of the Sahel Network, which is a button you can click if you would like to join and become one of our friends who's interested in the Sahel region of Africa.
We've been speaking with public health expert Alicia Graves about a solution for climate change where each of us does have some power, and that's giving women the choice on reproduction and producing fewer high-carbon consumers. As always, listeners, you can find those links just mentioned and more in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Alicia, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Alex.
Let's talk about extreme precipitation events. News about record rains or sometimes snow has become so frequent I could do a show on it every week. Just recently, a half dozen people died in floods in Louisiana. Parts of Brazil were hit with half their average monthly rainfall in just one day. In the desert, the United Arab Emirates just recorded their highest single day rainfall ever, 50 times normal for March. New research says this is only going to get worse as the world warms, but with an unexpected twist, for me at least. A letter published in the journal Nature Climate Change is titled More Extreme Precipitation in the World's Dry and Wet Regions. In Sydney, Australia, we've reached the lead author, Marcus G. Donat, a research fellow at the Climate Change Research Institute at the University of New South Wales. Marcus, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Yeah, hi.
Good. Well, let's start here. How do we define extreme precipitation?
Oh, there's certainly many ways to define extreme precipitation. It really depends on what you're interested in. Yeah, if it's a prolonged rain event that brings you extreme rainfall over several days, or in many cases, it's really just the very short and intense storms that bring large amounts of rain just in a few hours. What we did in this study was considering extreme rain as the annual maximum of the rainfall amounts that falls within one day. So basically, we had daily recordings from many parts of the world, and basically, we're just choosing the annual maximum of all of these annual values. And this measure is for us a good compromise between capturing relevant extremes but also having a reasonable global coverage, because these global totals of rainfall are a temporary aggregation that is observed in many and also reported from many parts of the world. So this helped us to increase the global coverage.
So the type of events that I just described as recent news, would that fit into the kind of research you're doing?
Absolutely, yes. So basically this measure of daily totals and looking into the annual maxima of these daily totals totally would still capture these kind of events that are related to intense storms, mainly of convective nature, that were related to those extreme rainfall events, for example.
For years, Marcus, scientists have told us as global warming proceeds, the dry places will get drier and the wet regions will get wetter. Is that really what you found?
This is actually not what we found, but we were not the first to basically challenge this wet get wetter, dry get drier which, theory, which has become kind of a paradigm. But this has also to do with the way the wet and the dry regions are defined, or what parts of the world you're considering. So the dry get drier, wet get wetter theory basically was based on a study by Held and Zonen in 2006, who analyzed climate model experiments and who considered basically the entire globe, including land and ocean. And in these climate model experiments, they basically found that the geographical latitudes that are usually dry would become drier in a warmer climate, and the latitudes that are usually wet would become wetter. But so this also depends on basically this very simplified spatial aggregation by just looking into certain latitude bands. There have been a number of studies recently looking into the whole pattern of precipitation changes more detailed, and they actually found, on the one hand, if you look into the different regions in a more geographical sense, with more geographical detail rather than just the latitude, then the picture might look different. And more importantly also, if you're only looking at precipitation over land, then this dry get drier, wet get wetter theory does not hold, even in the climate model.
If the dry places on Earth get more rainfall, isn't that good news?
In part. In terms of water balances, it is certainly better than receiving even less rainfall. However, as these increases are related to increasing global temperatures in terms of global warming, they go also in hand with in higher temperatures. And so if you're thinking about water availability, it's a bit more complex than just saying there is more rain, because at the same time, there might also be more evaporation as the climate becomes warmer. And so the balance between the evaporation and the increased rainfall, and so there might not be more water available, for example, for growing plants. At the same time, what we focused on with this study was not only looking into the changes of the total precipitation, but also extending the whole analysis to rainfall extremes, the kind of extremes we talked about earlier, yeah, basically the maxima of the daily rainfall amounts. And here we see that these extremes show very robust increases between the observations and the climate models with climate warming, because these rain events usually are storms that bring a lot of water just in a very short time period of a day or less. This then, it's a significant result in terms of flooding and related impacts like soil erosion, for example.
Yes, it can cause a lot of economic damage and damage to people's lives when their houses flood, their business flood, the road floods out, and so on. So your study is saying that we can expect more of that, more damage, as the climate warms.
Exactly. So basically, as the climate warms, the atmosphere can hold more water. So there's in physics a relationship, it's called the Clausius-Clapeyron relationship, and this defines what's the saturation water pressure of water in the atmosphere, and it tells us that with every degree of higher air temperatures, the air can hold about 6 to 7% more water vapor. And so if this increased amount of water vapor in atmosphere all rains out at the same time, then this would be related to stronger rainfall extremes and the related impacts that you were just talking about, correct?
Okay, now a senior, say somebody who's 60 years old, is looking back and they think they never saw those kind of rainfall events. I'm always hearing this on the news, well, I never saw rain like this before. Is that true?
Well, let's say at any individual location, it is really hard to measure these things, to really see if it's a record or not. This is related to several factors. On the one hand, precipitation, in particular extreme precipitation time series, are very variable in time. So we also call it very noisy in time. So this means that they show a lot of fluctuation between different years. For example, there are years that are very wet. There are other years that are very dry. And so if looking at any really just individual location, it is very hard to actually find statistically robust, statistically significant trends in these very noisy time series. What we have to do to basically get a clearer picture of the signal of the actual change compared to the noise is, for example, we would have to aggregate spatially by basically, for example, calculating a spatial average over a slightly larger region rather than just looking at one station time series. And this averaging reduces the noise, reduces the strong variability that is apparent in the individual time series, and then really helps us to more clearly actually see the signal, which is the signal which in this case is then the long-term trend in the extreme precipitation, for example. So if somebody experiences a record rainfall at a specific location, and let's say an old person, as you were referring to, has never seen this before, this might in fact be true for this location and also in the memory of this person. But doing such analysis globally over larger regions where all the different time series have a lot of noise, it's a statement that's really hard to prove statistically.
Going forward, what does this study suggest will be happening by 2050 or 2100? Will records continue to fall so much that we just expect rains to become heavier all the time?
Yeah, exactly. So actually in this study, we also looked into future climate projections. So one part of the study really looked into the past 60 years where we could compare observations to what the climate models were doing. And we found that actually with the way we analyzed the data here, there's a high robustness, there's a really strong agreement between what we're observing and what the models are doing. So this really gives us confidence that the models actually are doing a pretty good job in simulating this kind of precipitation extremes we're looking at here. And so in the second step, we then also looked into the future simulations, future projections of the climate, for which obviously we don't have observations, but the climate models are a useful tool to look into the future. And these simulations actually suggested the tendencies that we've observed for the past 60 years will continue over the next century. So basically we looked until the end of the 21st century, and so we see clear continuing increases in the precipitation extremes in these dry and also in the wet regions in the future projections of the climate models. And we then also tried to understand these increases a bit more detailed, because they show actually a wide range of increases, and maybe a wider range than we would be happy with giving as an indication, for example, to stakeholders. At the same time, the different future projections, as they were, example, also presented in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change assessment reports. And here we also see that actually the increase in global temperatures shows quite a range between the different models. Yeah, for example, it might increase between 3 and 6 degrees globally for a given scenario. And so what we tried also in this study was to relate basically the precipitation response to the global climate response. And here we also found a very strong relationship that actually the spread, the uncertainty in future rainfall simulations, future rainfall projections, is strongly related to the amount of global warming to this particular model. So basically a model that shows a stronger global warming also shows a stronger precipitation response, in particular in the drier regions, whereas a model that shows less warming in response to increased greenhouse gases also shows a slightly weaker response in these extreme precipitation measures. So that we can really formulate this relationship that there's basically this dependence of precipitation changes on global temperature changes.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Marcus Donat from the University of New South Wales in Australia. I'm wondering, do extreme rainfalls occur more in certain regions? For example, will they hit the developing world harder than Europe or North America?
Well, this is a question that's still hard to answer for us. So what we knew already before the study is that on a global average, we're seeing more extreme rainfall and also more intense extreme rainfall. But the spatial patterns of how it's exactly changing in a specific region still were quite uncertain, because there's some disagreement also between different observational data sets and in particular also between the observations and the climate models. So to get closer to regional information, we took a slightly different approach in this study. We did not, for example, look into a specific country in, for example, Africa, and and compared it to changes, for example, in the U.S. to have this comparison between developed and undeveloped world. What we did here was really looking into all the regions globally that are dry and all the regions globally that are wet, and analyzing the changes in these as an average over these dry regions and over these wet regions. But this means that, for example, we're putting together the changes in, say, North Africa and the Sahara with the Australian desert regions, but also with the dry regions in Southwest North America. This approach helped us to get this really consistent results, but still it is possible that in individual locations that are contributing to this larger average, there may be some different changes. So unfortunately, we are not yet really able to tell if a specific country, a specific region will be more strongly affected than others.
Well, as we wrap up, I want to ask you, are you personally concerned about our future if climate change goes further or faster than the IPCC has forecast?
I am certainly concerned in a sense that this will change the planet we are living on. This basically also calls for the responsibility of all of us, but particularly of the politics, to find solutions to help people who may not be able to live in the place where they lived before. This is probably the major impact. I don't think that we have to talk about horror scenarios that the Earth will basically not longer be a livable place, or that humans may even get extinct or something like this. It is more really that maybe some regions are no longer good regions to live in terms of course, we're talking on the one hand about sea level rise, so some land areas may just disappear. But we're also talking about other changes, such as there might be still areas where drought increases, and it may not be possible to grow crops and to basically have a living there. And so there must be solutions just to settle those people elsewhere. In addition, of course, there's impacts to ecosystems. There might be extinctions to certain plant and animal species. And these are all just losses that are not reversible and that make me pessimistic. But the whole global warming science and the impacts it has on so many aspects of the world is a very complex thing, and there's many aspects to worry about. But I also think that our life and our society will continue. We just have to be prepared that it might be differently, and that we will have to find solutions for several impacts that are related to this warming.
Okay. From the University of New South Wales Climate Change Research Center and the ARC Center of Excellence for Climate Systems Science, we've been speaking with Marcus G. Donat. He's the lead author of a research letter just published in the journal Nature Climate Change. It's titled More Extreme Precipitation in the World's Dry and Wet Regions. Marcus, thank you for spending time with us.
Yeah, it was my pleasure. Thank you.
We're out of time, in this radio show at least. Join me every week for Radio EcoShock and get all the links for this program and the weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Thank you for listening and caring about your world.
It's the Real News Network. I'm Sharmini Peres coming to you from Baltimore. During the Democratic debate on Thursday night in New York City, there was a heated exchange between Clinton and Sanders about whether Israel used disproportionate force in the summer of 2014, that is, in the 50-day war against Palestinians living in the Gaza Strip. Let me remind everyone that according to the UN, that war killed 2,131 Palestinians in the 50 days. 1,473 were civilians, including 501 kids, children, and 257 women, and it left 1,500 children orphaned. During the same period, 71 Israelis were killed by Palestinians, and that included 66 soldiers and 4 civilians. Now, getting back to the debate last night, let's have a look at how each of the Democratic candidates responded to this question of proportionality posed by Wolf Blitzer of CNN.
Senator Sanders, you maintained that Israel's response in Gaza in 2014 was, quote, disproportionate and led to the unnecessary loss of innocent life. What do you say to those who believe that Israel has a right to defend itself as it sees fit?
Well, as somebody who spent many months of my life when I was a kid in Israel, who has family in Israel, of course Israel has a right not only to defend themselves, but to live in peace and security without fear of terrorist attack. That is not a debate. But, what you just read, yeah, I do believe that. Israel was subjected to terrorist attacks, has every right in the world to destroy terrorism. But we had in the Gaza area, not a very large area, some 10,000 civilians who were wounded and some 1,500 who were killed. Now, if you're asking me, not just me, but countries all over the world, was that a disproportionate attack? The answer is, I believe it was. And let me say something else.
The way that Hamas places its weapons, the way that it often has its fighters in civilian garb, it is terrible. I'm not saying it's anything other than terrible, but it would be great. Remember, Israel left Gaza. They took out all the Israelis. They turned the keys over to the Palestinian people. And what happened? Hamas took over Gaza. So instead of having a thriving economy with the kind of opportunities that the children of the Palestinians deserve, we have a terrorist haven that is getting more and more rockets shipped in from Iran and elsewhere.
Joining us now from Chicago to discuss this is Ali Abunima. Ali is co-founder of the award-winning online publication, The Electronic Intifada. His latest book is The Battle for Justice in Palestine. Ali, good to have you with us.
Thank you, Sharmini. It's great to be back.
So, Ali, let me get your reaction to the two candidates' response to this question of disproportionality.
Well, I mean, let's start with Hillary. She repeated in that clip and throughout their exchange every discredited lie and propaganda point from Israel's most extreme and most racist government. I mean, even in that little clip, she claims Hamas took over Gaza. She neglects to say that Hamas won an election that the United States demanded the Palestinians have, and they won it fair and square. She repeats these discredited lies that, you know, Hamas is using Palestinians as human shields, and that somehow justifies or excuses all the deaths that you listed in the introduction. And, of course, there's mountains of evidence discrediting these lines, from the independent UN Human Rights Council inquiry to Amnesty International to Human Rights Watch to the Palestinian Center for Human Rights to even Israeli human rights groups. But that didn't stop Hillary beating up on dead Palestinians and repeating these discredited lies. What we heard from Sanders, on the other hand, was really the minimum we should hear from any honest person talking about this. I mean, frankly, I don't like the term disproportionate because that suggests that any of Israel's attacks on Gaza are justified, and I think none of them are justified. But But that exchange, and it was actually a 10-minute long exchange, was extraordinary because we've never seen a major party candidate of the stature of Bernie Sanders challenge this orthodoxy. He challenged Hillary over her speak at AIPAC recently. He said, you know, Netanyahu is not always right. And for the context of American politics, these were actually pretty extraordinary statements and quite an extraordinary exchange.
And Ali, we had not had the benefit of having your commentary the last few weeks because you were actually out of the country. But Bernie Sanders did issue a position paper on the Middle East while you were away. I'm wondering whether you had an opportunity to take a look at it, giving us a better sense of what his position is when it comes to Israel-Palestine.
Well, his position, actually his long-standing position, you know, going back to the late 1980s in the first Palestinian uprising since the 1967 occupation began, is, you know, he actually used to say back then, cut off military aid to Israel. More recently, his positions have not been so clear. In fact, there's a notorious video clip of him angrily silencing constituents in Vermont who are challenging him over the attack on Gaza. What appears to have happened in the course of the campaign is that Sanders is much more willing to be forthright about criticizing Israel and calling for, you know, the way he put it, respect and dignity for the Palestinian people, even-handedness. That's another word he used. And, you know, his positions are sort of standard support the two-state solution positions. In that sense, he's not very radical. But to say the U.S. should be even-handed, to talk about treating the Palestinians with respect and dignity, you know, in the, again, I'm talking about in the context of U.S. politics, those are, pushing the envelope. And it's also interesting that the other candidate who talked about being even-handed and used the word even-handed is Donald Trump. So what it shows is that these outsider candidates are challenging a bipartisan orthodoxy that says, it must be Israel right or wrong. And what's, I think, significant is that Sanders is doing this with overwhelming support of a new generation that doesn't buy into Hillary's extremist Netanyahu right or wrong anti-Palestinian positions. Sanders has the support of a significant part of the Democratic base to take these kinds of positions. And I think they're actually pushing him, because I think if left to his own devices and his own instincts, we've seen he doesn't go this far. I think he's reflecting a change in the base of the Democratic Party and more widely among young people and people in the United States.
I think you're absolutely right there, because this is the first time I've seen a debate within the Democratic Party that really takes on Israel. And a lot of people reference the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement as being one of the reasons, which, as you said, is something that's pushed for by the next generation, by the younger people who are actually supporters of Bernie Sanders, bringing it to the forefront of political debate in this country. I'm wondering whether that resonates with you.
Definitely. And there was this incident that should be mentioned where the Sanders campaign had appointed an outreach person to the Jewish community who was said to be, you know, supportive of BDS, and then suspended her, apparently, from what I've read, over a post she'd written some time ago that was very critical of Netanyahu.
You're speaking about Simone Zimmerman.
Exactly. And, you know, a lot of people pointed to that and said, well, that's inconsistent. But definitely, you know, Simone Zimmerman represents a much broader generational shift. where you know, young Americans, including young Jewish Americans, are not succumbing to the appeal of, you know, of sort of knee-jerk support for Israel. What's also an interesting shift is that what Bernie Sanders did by challenging Hillary over her APAC speech is he reflected a much broader shift within the Democratic Party that even includes the mainstream Democratic Party of starting to view APAC as a Republican vehicle and no longer sort of a bipartisan forum where you used to get this parade of Republican and Democrat members of Congress and leaders and so on. We're seeing more broadly Democrats turning away from APAC and, you know, support for Israel becoming a much more partisan issue. And as it comes to BDS, people are signing up, you know, to express their support for BDS in droves because it's proving successful. We've seen big companies pulling out of Israel in recent months, and really because it's the only game in town. You know, Hillary talks about, oh, we have to do all we can to help get to peace. But what does she really actually do? All she does is give 100% unconditional support to Israel, to its settlements, to its wars on Gaza, whereas BDS offers a nonviolent strategy to actually put pressure on Israel to get to something like justice. And Sanders even used the word justice, which has been a total taboo when it comes to talking about Israel-Palestine in mainstream politics. So, you know, what I don't want to do is sort of overstate how great Sanders' personal positions are, because I think that, you know, they fall short in many ways. But I think what he did last night was significant in making this a big issue, in confronting Hillary's knee-jerk support for Israel head-on, and in reflecting this broader change that's happening among young people, including a lot of young people who support the Palestinian call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions, and see that now as the real peace process, not the kind of thing that Hillary's boasting about, that she used to meet with Arafat and she used to meet with Abbas and this Israeli prime minister and that Israeli prime minister. I think young people understand that that has only led to more occupation, more settlements, more apartheid, more death for Palestinians. And they're signing up to this Palestinian-led BDS movement because they see real hope in it.
Ali Abu Nimai, thank you so much for joining us. And there's a lot more to unpack in terms of the Clintons' role as well as Bill Clinton's role in terms of Israel and their allegiance to it, which we hope to do another time. Thanks so much, Ali.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And thank you for joining us on the Real News Network.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap. Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present James S. Henry of the Tax Justice Network, who assesses the significance of the leaked Panama Papers documents that expose how some politicians in the world's wealthiest people hide their money in tax shelters. Former NASA climate scientist James Hansen, who explains why he believes sea level rise linked to climate change is on track to occur faster and at higher levels than previous estimates. And Margrethe Strand, Executive Vice President of Public Citizen, who talks about the Democracy Awakening actions in Washington, D.C., demanding legislative reforms to rein in the corrupting influence of big money in U.S. politics. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
McClatchy Newspapers reports that there's a new and growing dissident activist network that sprung up in Cuba since President Barack Obama initiated warmer relations with that island nation 15 months ago. They say people are more willing to voice their frustrations as they see an opening for change in the relationship with the United States. That growth is in part the reason for the step-up in the Cuban government's crackdown on dissidents that was evident during President Obama's 48-hour visit to the island. Dozens of activists were arrested before Obama's arrival. However, many activists are not actually jailed, but are held briefly or given house arrest. William Leo Grand, co-author of the book Back Channel to Cuba, says fear may be too strong a word to describe the Cuban government's concerns about its new relationship with the United States, but he said it's undoubtedly the case that Cuban leaders want to impress upon dissidents that the opening doesn't mean they'll tolerate activity they regard as subversive. At a joint press conference with Obama during his visit, Cuban leader Raul Castro rejected the idea posed by reporters that his government had imprisoned anyone for speaking out against the government. He countered by saying that Cuba had honored the most sacred rights, the ones guaranteeing universal health care, education, and equal pay for women in the workplace. Castro called on the United States to abandon the Guantanamo Bay military base and to lift the U.S. embargo against Cuba. He said relations would never be fully normal until both these things were accomplished. With sinking global oil prices, Angola, Africa's second largest oil producer, is seeking a bailout from the International Monetary Fund. Already in 2016, Angola's currency, the Kwanza, has fallen 16% due to low oil prices, and government spending has dropped by 20%. The West African nation had borrowed heavily from China and its former colonizer, Portugal. Angola is now seeking a three-year bailout that could exceed $8 billion. The IMF is expected to impose new austerity measures in Angola, limiting the prospects for future growth. Currently, oil production accounts for 95% of Angola's exports and over half of all government revenue. 50% of Angola's 24 million people live in extreme poverty, despite the nation's oil wealth. Angola's move reflects the growing stresses being felt by oil producers across the developing world that have been hit hard by a collapse in crude oil prices and are now struggling to plug the gaps left by dwindling revenues. Countries ranging from Azerbaijan to Nigeria have in recent months been engaging in discussions with the IMF, World Bank, and other multilateral institutions over how to cope with the oil price fallout. Massive budget cuts by outgoing Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal have put the state's public defender system in peril. The cuts to legal services are so severe that it has endangered the right to a fair trial for poor criminal defendants. The budget for public defenders in the Bayou State will be slashed by 61% in fiscal year 2017, creating unmanageable caseloads where attorneys are unable to consult with every defendant who needs representation. In response, the American Civil Liberties Union filed a lawsuit to compel the state legislature to adequately fund the public defender system. Governor Jindal came into office with a $1 billion surplus driven by high oil prices, but the conservative governor and failed presidential candidate followed the Republican playbook of cutting taxes for the wealthy and exempting corporations from paying income tax, a strategy that resulted in Louisiana's $2 billion deficit. According to the American Prospect magazine, a shortage of public defenders is forcing many presumed innocent defendants to be warehoused in overcrowded jails without benefit of counsel. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
Most of our listeners will have heard of or read about a set of leaked confidential files known as the Panama Papers, 11.5 million documents that provide detailed information on the shareholders and directors of more than 214,000 offshore corporations. The documents were leaked from the Panamanian-based law firm Mossack Fonseca that assists some of the world's richest people and corporations to establish shell companies in low-tax haven nations, used to conceal wealth. The names of 140 politicians from more than 50 countries linked to secret offshore accounts in the documents have thus far included the Prime Minister of Iceland, who was forced to resign, Pakistan's Prime Minister, the Presidents of Argentina and Ukraine, the King of Saudi Arabia, senior Chinese officials, and some close associates of Russian President Vladimir Putin. British Prime Minister David Cameron's father was also connected to a Panamanian offshore account. An anonymous source originally provided the Panama Papers to a German newspaper in early 2015, but due to the overwhelming volume of documents, the editors sought help from the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, which distributed the data to 400 journalists at 107 media outlets across the world. Your reporter spoke with James S. Henry, a senior fellow at Columbia University's Center for Sustainable International Investment and a senior advisor to the Tax Justice Network. Here he assesses the significance of the leaked Panama Papers documents, which represents just the tip of the iceberg of where the world's wealthiest people and corporations hide their money in tax shelters.
Well, this is by far the largest leak in history. We've had 214,438 companies that were set up by this company and the documents associated with those. The clients are from 200 countries, and they include, so far, we've identified about 22 current heads of state, 143 people in political office, quite a few family members who are associated closely with current or former heads of state, and quite a few people on the Fortune 500 list. So it's an incredible accumulation of influential people. This case is about kleptocracy in terms of public officials helping themselves to public assets or having offshore wealth that they can't explain, maybe due to corruption and bribery. And for many countries, especially in the developing world, kleptocracy is a more important issue. You know, corruption is a more important issue than just tax dodging.
I wonder if you could explain to our audience how the Mossack Fonseca revelations fit into the global tax avoidance that you've estimated at between $21 and $32 trillion in private wealth in offshore tax havens. And that doesn't include the trillions of dollars more in wealth hidden by many global corporations.
That's right, and it doesn't include non-financial assets like real estate, yachts, art collections. I mean, the tax angle to this, you know, our estimates are as of 2010. What we've seen since then is that the numbers for the worldwide haven industry have grown even farther, especially from countries like Russia and China, which have been in the last 2 or 3 years subject to a huge amount of capital outflow and, you know, $1 trillion from China in the last 18 months. Russia probably has more than 1.3 trillion offshore. Argentina, leading Latin American countries have more than 2.5 trillion offshore, which is more than twice their external debt. So a lot of this is motivated by taxation, but it's also motivated by political risk, kind of the ruling elite. And, you know, but I think what you have to imagine is something like the Star Wars bar scene where you have the drug dealers, the tax dodgers, the kleptocrats, the people worried about being raided by the political police, you know, all gathered around using the same basic facilities, which are offshore companies and trusts that are very easy to set up in other people's names with nominee directors. There's one lady who is a secretary for Fonseca listed as a director for 24,000 letterbox companies that were set up, all of them owned by non-residents of Panama. So it's this financial secrecy kind of facility, the lack of any registration of so-called beneficial owners, so we don't know who owns what. And I think that's one big contributor to this, but it's also this network of basically unscrupulous law firms, banks, and accounting firms that are channeling all of this business to these people and the public officials that have failed for 40 years to crack down on this.
Well, just a final quick one here. What would be the top actions you would like to see the U.S. government take in coalition with other governments around the world to close off these tax loopholes and make the playing field more even for all taxpayers?
The International Commission with subpoena power, like they had in Guatemala, I'd like to have beneficial ownership registration in the public register so we tell who owns what. I'd like to have public officials have to release their tax returns and declare their offshore and onshore wealth. And I'd like to have tougher penalties for the banks and other enablers that are in this business. And I'd like to have a blacklist for havens that keep getting caught doing this over and over again, like Panama and to some extent like Delaware.
That was James S. Henry, a senior fellow at Columbia University's Center for Sustainable International Investment and a senior advisor at the Tax Justice Network. Find more perspectives and analysis on the Panama Papers by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Former NASA climate scientist James Hansen is one of the world's leading experts on climate change. He testified before Congress back in 1988 that global warming was already occurring due to the burning of fossil fuels, becoming one of the first scientists to go on record. He now works at Columbia University's Earth Institute, and in late March published an important paper in the journal Atmospheric Chemistry and Physics titled
Ice melt, sea level rise, and superstorms. Evidence from paleoclimate data, climate modeling, and modern observations that 2 degrees centigrade global warming could be dangerous. The paper posits that sea level rise is on track to occur faster and at higher levels than more conservative estimates, like that of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, have predicted. An agreement signed by 195 countries in Paris last year seeks to cut greenhouse gas emissions, but it's not remotely ambitious enough to limit global warming to the degree Dr. Hansen regards as necessary. Hansen is party to a lawsuit against the federal government filed by the group Our Children's Trust for not protecting young people and future generations from the ravages of climate change. On April 8th, the judge ruled in favor of the 21 youthful plaintiffs, which moves their lawsuit one step closer to trial. Hansen visited Yale University April 6th through the 8th as the Yale Climate Change and Health Initiative's climate change leader in residence. What follows are excerpts from his April 7th talk at Yale, where Dr. Hansen discussed his new study. He uses the term paleoclimate to refer to studies of the climate dating back hundreds of thousands of years. The term forcing refers to anything that forces the climate system to go out of equilibrium, resulting either in an increase in temperature or a decrease, which is called a negative forcing.
I think the climate response function of models, of climate models, is too lethargic compared to the real world. You know, the paleoclimate evidence tells us that when ice sheets disintegrate, they can disintegrate quite rapidly and give you several meters of sea level rise in a century, even though the forcings that caused those paleoclimate changes were much weaker than the human-made forcing. I argue that when the ice sheets disintegrate, it's going to be a very nonlinear process and is probably better characterized by a doubling time than it is by a more linear assumption. But we don't know what the characteristic time would be. So I just say, let's assume that there's up to 5 meters of sea level rise. There's ice equivalent to that, which is vulnerable to contact with the ocean. Because the threat of rapid sea level rise is caused by the fact that parts of the ice sheets are in contact with the ocean. And that ocean water can cause relatively rapid melting of ice shelves. And once ice shelves are melted, then the ice sheets can discharge icebergs to the ocean much more rapidly. And there's at least 5 meters of sea level rise in the West Antarctic plus parts of the East Antarctica and parts of Greenland that is vulnerable to rapid change. So it depends on what we do with our fuel use. If we stay on business as usual, and right now, as long as fossil fuels are allowed to be the cheapest energy, then regardless of these statements that were made in Paris in December, those are practically worthless. If we stay on that path, then I see no way that we could avoid. I think we would get several meters of sea level rise this century. We say 50 to 150 years, but we have to keep our eye on Greenland and Antarctica the next several years and just see how that rate continues to change. But the question is, have we passed a point at which that it's inevitable that we're going to lose the West Antarctic ice sheet? I'm not sure about that, but this amplifying feedback in the Southern Ocean has to make you very concerned. We have to restore the planet's energy balance. As long as there's more energy coming in than going out, then ice is going to keep melting. And to restore the energy balance requires that we actually get CO2 to go down. And that's very hard, but that's what we're asking in the lawsuit that we filed against the federal government, or Our Children's Trust has filed against it. We're asking the government to give a plan for how they're going to reduce emissions at a rate that would be consistent with restoring the planet's energy balance in a century. And if we did that, I think we probably could minimize sea level rises. We're not going to avoid it altogether.
An audience member asked, what is the role of methane in Dr. Hansen's climate modeling? Natural or fracked gas is composed mostly of methane, which creates 86 times more global warming, molecule for molecule, than carbon dioxide in the first 20 years after release.
Methane is actually quite important. The human-made methane increase also causes tropospheric ozone to increase and stratospheric water vapor to increase. And so when you include those indirect effects of methane, the forcing is about 7/10 of a watt per meter squared, which is at least as large as the planet's energy balance. So if we would just stop the emissions, human-made emissions of methane, we could restore the planet's energy balance if CO2 then all stayed the same. It's a big factor, because the reason that you could restore it is that the methane lifetime is only about 10 or 12 years. So it would go back to its pre-industrial level. So it has to be a part of the plan for how you're going to restore the planet's energy balance. But unless we get CO2 under control, that methane knob is just not powerful enough. So I don't emphasize it. You've got to make policymakers think of the major knob, and that's the CO2 knob.
That was an excerpt of a talk by climate scientist Dr. James Hansen, delivered at Yale University on April 7th. This segment was recorded and produced by Between the Lines Melinda Tuhus. Find links to Hansen's latest study and related articles by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. With the almost daily bombast and insults emanating from Republican presidential candidate and real estate billionaire Donald Trump, the 2016 election campaign has been more a source of crude media entertainment than an informed national debate about public policy and the future of the country. But while cable news channels and other commercial media outlets trip over themselves to fill the airwaves with Trump-related content to cash in on ratings-driven profits, the American people have come to believe that the U.S. political system is broken. In a recent public opinion poll conducted by Gallup in March of this year, some 66% of those surveyed believe that the U.S. presidential election process is dysfunctional and in need of repair. One major factor contributing to Americans' loss of faith in the nation's machinery of democracy is an overwhelming bipartisan rejection of the 2010 Supreme Court Citizens United decision that opened the floodgates of unlimited and unaccountable money in U.S. politics, where a handful of billionaires now have unchecked power to influence election outcomes. With so much disgust at the way U.S. politics is run, and the 2016 election campaign on track to be the most expensive in U.S. history, a coalition of more than 260 groups are supporting a series of protests in Washington, D.C., called Democracy Spring and Democracy Awakening, April 11th through the 18th. Their activists are demanding voting rights reforms, the overturning of Citizens United, and the filling of the U.S. Supreme Court vacancy. The actions, which kicked off on April 2nd with a march from Philadelphia to Washington, will include teach-ins, rallies, direct action, and will culminate on April 18th with mass civil disobedience at the U.S. Capitol building. Your reporter spoke with Margretta Strand, Public Citizens Executive Vice President, a Democracy Awakening Coalition partner, who talks about the corrupting influence of big money in U.S. politics and the goals of the Democracy Awakening protest.
A lot of things that are happening right now, a lot of excitement, lots of grassroots people. I was up at the rally today. People had flown in from Denver and Seattle, sort of pretty much every state being represented. We're expecting thousands of people here this coming weekend, and it's pretty exciting. We're coming together on three demands that are sort of core to our democracy: get big money out of politics, restore voting rights and have a vote on the Supreme Court nominee. And our website is democracyawakening.org, which has a lot of information about what's being planned.
Tell us a little bit about what ties all these issues together, confronting the failure of U.S. politics to address key issues, the machinery of elections, which a lot of people feel is suspect or a failed project in many respects, as well as the economy, which is failing most people. All these things seem to be linked in my mind, maybe many of our listeners' mind. And that, I think, is one of the major elements of bringing all these groups together that you've put together here in this week of actions.
At the bottom of what we're trying to do, whether you care about climate change or whether you're in a, you know, fighting for your union, and whether you're talking about healthcare or immigration, I think more and more people are starting to see that we cannot make progress on those issues when the system is rigged in the way it is right now, where the very few, very wealthy pour unlimited amount of money into the political system, where we're going backwards on voting rights, and where we have a Congress that is completely broken at this point, the point of obstructions that we see now, what we see happening around the Supreme Court, and so forth. And we're left with this election cycle that is reduced to pretty meaningless discussions oftentimes. And so I think what we're trying to do is bring some of these issues back into the front. You know, we, Public Citizen, did a report earlier this week talking about how in none of the debates in the presidential race has there been a conversation about money in politics. What would you as a candidate do about Citizens United? How do you see the role of money playing? How can we make change? None of those questions are coming up. The fact that people's right to vote is being jeopardized, all of these questions are not being talked about. And that's what we feel are the important honor pinnings of everything we try to do. We have 270 organizations that are part of Democracy Awakening from all the spectrums of different issues. Why? Because we have to deal with these issues to make progress on any of the other things that we're working on. So that's part of what's exciting with the thousands of people that will be coming, with all these groups working together. It's really creating a movement for some of these very fundamental issues that we have to address.
Tell us about some of the varied organizations and types of groups that are involved in the coalition that's put Democracy Awakening together.
It's anything from big unions like the AFL-CIO and SEIU to smaller groups. Jim Hightower is going to be there, Friends of the Earth Sierra Club. We have Southern Illinois People for Progress. I'm just looking at the website. So it's a really great mix, the NAACP, Common Cause, Public Citizen. It's a big mix of both small and large, national and local, from every kind of issue area that, you know, you can sort of imagine, that's coming together, and it's all listed on our website. Part of what's exciting is, you know, these are groups who don't necessarily work on these issues as their core issue. You know, if you're the Sierra Club, you wake up in the morning and you want to address climate change. But now they're not able to really do that. And I think the fact that large organizations are starting to see that we also need to work on money in politics, we also need to work on voting rights if we're going to have an impact on climate, that's what you see reflected in these 270 groups that are participating.
As you look at electoral politics in this country and how change is made in our own history and history around the world, it seems pretty clear that movements make change and elections rarely make change. That's my view anyway. What's your perspective on building a movement and its importance to make the changes that our elections often really aren't capable of doing?
Well, no, I mean, I completely agree with you. And part of what I think it's exciting about people coming together in Washington this weekend is not that there's a protest in D.C., what I think is exciting is that it is actually genuinely building on a movement that has been growing around the country for years. This is sort of the ground war, right, where you're sort of building your coalition, you're getting more and more people engaged, you're creating that nationally, you're taking it out around the country. People on the ground are moving things forward, and that does lead to change.
That was Margretta Strand, Executive Vice President with Public Citizen. Find more information on the Democracy Spring and Democracy Awakening protest actions by visiting our Between the Lines website
at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to our free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
Clintonism laid bare. Bill Clinton, perhaps the best raw political animal of his generation, said a mouthful recently, especially when he confronted activists from the ubiquitous Black Lives Matter movement. There, the primary political architect of the mass incarceration phenomenon of the 90s, defended his position with classic Clintonian doublespeak. He argued that the imprisonment boom that he fathered was done to protect blacks from other blacks. Quote Clinton, "How can you defend those vicious gang leaders who sent 13-year-olds into the streets to do their killing?" This, in response to Hillary Clinton's venal denunciation of super predators, which gave rise to the greatest imprisonment boom on earth, was defended by Clinton in a way only Bill Clinton could have done. Essentially, he argued, "We did it for you." One needs to go back to the tortured prose of the Dred Scott decision to find something so audacious. There, that old slave owner and Chief Justice, Roger Brooke Taney, argued that the Negro was subjected to slavery for his own benefit. I guess great minds think alike, huh? Bill Clinton unleashed the greatest imprisonment boom in American history to protect black folks from black children, you know, the super predators. This is Clintonism. Neoliberalism equals so-called compassionate conservatism for the good of the natives. He didn't do it to employ tens of thousands of rural whites in the containment so-called corrections industry. He didn't do it to create tens of thousands of new state workers who would donate to the Democratic Party for generations. He didn't do it because it gave lower class whites a sense of entitlement and a recession-proof profession. He didn't do it because it was the new way that Democrats governed, tougher, meaner. He did it because he felt black pain. He did it for you. This is Clintonism. Wars for profit. Prisons for profit. More jails equal more jobs, right? More cops, more crime. See, it works out, doesn't it? Hillary Clinton apologized for her choice of words. Bill Clinton, being Bill Clinton, bragged about it. "I did it for y'all," he yells. Voting for Clintonism promises more of the same. Hey, good luck with that. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. Of a poisonous tree. In legal theory, there is something known as the fruit of the poisonous tree doctrine, which holds that an illegal search, arrest, or interrogation poisons or taints all that follows, and as such, it may not be used in a prosecution. If that is so, what if America's failed and corrupt so-called drug war as poisoned a fruit as possible, born as it was, from political lies meant to cover state attacks on radicals, especially black radicals? The recent revelations of former Nixon White House aide John Ehrlichman that drugs were used as a proxy to target blacks and hippies should poison all that sprouted from that foul and loathsome plant. The dirtiest of Dick Nixon's dirty tricks. It has led to the explosion of prisons in American life and the subsequent crippling of millions of families for half a century. The so-called drug war is thus a lie, built on a lie, and used by the state to repress, harass, disrupt, and destroy. Yesterday, the prison ran a dog line, where a pooch ran down a line of prisoners waiting to go to yard. It was as ridiculous as it was revealing. For if there are drugs in prison, it's more likely than not that a staff member brought it in rather than a prisoner. No dog lines for staff, though, huh? The false drug war has, like all wars, been far more destructive than it has been creative, and it has corrupted and poisoned all that has been touched by it. It has corrupted cops who have profited from it as well as become drug merchants. It has reduced the Fourth Amendment to shreds, even as it has intellectually corrupted courts, which ignore the Constitution to further a false war on drugs. It has placed black and Latino youth under lifelong suspicion, subjecting them to arbitrary and oppressive searches, seizures, and arrests. It has fueled the boom in the prison industry. A false war, yes, but which has had real life and death effects from imprisoned nation. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal. The sight and sound of Hillary Rodham Clinton speaking to black folks in Harlem was a reminder of why politics and politicians are so repellent. Promises, promises. Coming from a Clinton, the architects of the greatest imprisonment boom in American history, which wrought immeasurable misery to millions of black folks for decades, such promises come with a bitter cup of betrayal. For blacks, the most loyal constituency of the Democratic Party, one wonders how much is too much. 1 million more prisoners? 1,000 more Sandra Blands? A bit more of the Mike Brown tragedies? The architects of mass incarceration promised to solve a problem they created, right? Hillary Clinton speaking to the grandmothers of the children she sneered at, no, snarled at, and damned as super predators. Imagine that. The Democratic Party, the former sponsors of the Ku Klux Klan, now want to turn a new face to black millions who wallow in pain. Vote for me and I'll set you free. Golden lies in golden skirts are still lies in Harlem. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
We have got a very difficult situation, still facing perhaps one of the most famous political prisoners in the world, Mumia Abu-Jamal. We know how many different ways, let us count the ways that the U.S. government has tried to kill this extraordinary journalist, a writer, a resistor, a political leader, really, former NPR reporter, and it goes on and on. Joining us to talk about the current medical situation is Dr. Corey Weinstein. He is a California-based doctor, spent several decades following and caring and fighting for proper medical care inside prisons. He's very familiar with the case of Abu-Jamal. And Dr. Weinstein, thanks for joining us. People are very concerned now, aren't they, in terms of the medical care. He's barely finally, after a lot of battling, getting the sort of the basics that he would need in terms of someone in his condition, but he is still in grave jeopardy. Yes?
Yes, he is, Dennis. I'm glad that I'm able to talk to you about it today. People may remember that almost exactly a year ago, Mumia was in a desperate medical circumstance in the critical care unit in a local hospital to his prison in Pennsylvania, as a result of the sudden onset of diabetes that was actually brought on by the treatment he had received for an undiagnosed skin condition that had been bothering him and slowly progressively worse over the year prior. Well, he survived that due to, really not due to anything that was happening in the prison because they delayed his care, but due to the heroic efforts of the doctors in the local hospital. And with that kind of wake-up call and the incredible support that he got from the outside, his care had been, after protests and his demanding, much better. And he was in the infirmary for a long time to care for this very difficult skin situation. It's an itchy, rash skin that at one point covered 70% of his body, and that the doctors who I read all the medical records as one of his medical consultants, and the doctors who were treating him wrote notes of shock and awe over the sheets of skin peeling off his back and things like that during the worst of the crisis. So it's a unique and terrible circumstance. So he did come out of that, and he's getting regular light therapy treatment that seemed to help a little bit. And he had a lot of local treatment, a lot of creams and ointments and dressings on his skin for a long time in the infirmary. Since then, he is now back on mainline. Well, back on mainline, he's not around doctors, he's not around nurses. And those treatments, the local treatments, have pretty much stopped, although he continues to get his light therapy treatments. But one thing that has occurred is that the doctors have kind of forgotten about him, and he's not getting his blood sugar checks to make sure he's not slipping back into diabetes. And over the past month, this is what has occurred. He's become tired, kind of lethargic, easily fatigued, and is gaining weight. And those are things that happen when diabetes might be possible. And so he has demanded now that he get his blood sugar checks, but we don't know if that's going to happen. In the back of this all, if you don't mind me going on.
Please.
In the back of this all is this lawsuit that is trying to get him appropriate treatment for his hepatitis C. He probably acquired hepatitis C during the early stage of his hospitalization after the incident in which he was shot, in which the police officer was killed, and as a result of transfusions. And he's they never tested him for it, despite his medical history, until a few years ago, and he tested positive for Hep C, and then no workup and no follow-up was done. Well, turns out that he has markers for degenerative disease of the liver due to Hep C, including cirrhosis, and there's a good chance, based on his blood tests, his platelet count, and a few other things, his blood counts, that, and some CAT scans and sonograms of his liver, that he does have cirrhosis. And by ordinary standards and by the national recommendations for these new liver drugs that are on, that he be treated, and people like him should be treated to prevent liver cirrhosis and tragedy from hepatitis C. His doctors there keep on insisting that his skin condition is not caused by hep C, despite the fact that there's this really undercurrent driver of this skin condition that persists, and that we know that up to 40% of people with hep C have skin disease. They say it's psoriasis, but their own diagnosis is that it's something like psoriasis and eczema. So even without a real positive diagnosis, they're going ahead and pretending it's psoriasis, so they can pretend that they're giving him definitive treatment, which of course they're not. The definitive treatment for his skin condition is treatment of his hepatitis C. So that's what the lawsuit is about. And so he's in this limbo with the lawsuit going on, and now seems to be slipping back into, I'm worried that he's slipping back into this kind of state that he was as he became sick over the winter and spring of last year. So there are things that people can do to kind of mobilize to demand further treatment and demand that he be looked into now.
And what would that be? What's the best way to, if people are interested in finding out more information or in trying to hold the officials accountable? I guess there's a number of officials and phone numbers and stuff. Where's the where do people get that information?
They can go up on the prison radio website.
Okay.
And on the front page, there will be a button to get to it. If you can't find that, I'm a little challenged computer elite myself. So a secondary thing would just be to email prisonradio@gmail.com, prisonradio, lowercase, one word, @gmail.com, and the people in that office will send you back the email blast that lists what you can do.
All right, Dr. Corey Weinstein spent many years dealing inside prisons, trying to get prisoners proper care, and it's still a tragedy what happens inside prisons. The battle goes on, and we will continue to cover it. Thanks so much, Doctor.
Are there grounds for questioning the legitimacy of this week's parliamentary elections in Syria? What is behind the outbreak and violence which threatens the recent ceasefire? Is the West truly committed to democracy in Syria? Are major media distorting the true picture of the Syrian situation and irresponsibly demonizing President Assad? On this week's Global Research News Hour, on a week when the Syrian people are heading for the polls, we hear from veteran broadcaster and Chicago-based independent journalist Stephen Lendman about the forces shaping the official Syrian narrative. We also speak with University of Sydney senior lecturer and book author Professor Tim Anderson about his research on Syria and what he has been observing from the ground in Damascus. On this week's program, The Dirty War on Syria, conversations with Stephen Lendman and Tim Anderson. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of April 15th, 2016. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on Treaty 1 territory in the heart of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Hillary is a warmonger. She pushed the Obama regime into the destruction of a stable and largely cooperative government in Libya, where the Arab Spring, quote-unquote, was a CIA-backed group of jihadists who were used to dislodge China from its oil investments in eastern Libya. She brought neoconservative Victoria Nuland, who arranged the coup that overthrew the democratically elected president of Ukraine, into the State Department. Hillary has called President Vladimir Putin of Russia the quote-unquote new Hitler. Hillary as president guarantees war and more war. That comes from the article, President Killery. Would the world survive President Hillary? By Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, posted April 13th, originally appearing in Compact and at paulcraigroberts.org. The Syrian elections proceeded according to the Syrian constitution and law. We see this being enforced in Aleppo, for example, where it was decided that violations of the voting process had taken place and a re-election was called for. UNSC, the Security Council Resolution 2254, stated clearly that Syria's future is in the hands of the Syrians, and the Syrians are proving that they are doing just that, with little fuss, but a lot of enthusiasm and determination to deny foreign intervention in their sovereign affairs. Now, let's have a look at the president that Western governments and their media minions would have us believe to be a bloodthirsty, butchering dictator as he and his wife Asma head for the polling booths with no security in sight. Compare this, if you will, to the protests being held across Britain demanding that David Cameron, a.k.a. Dodgy Dave, resign over the Panama Papers scandal, the subsequent police clampdown, and the manhandling of protesters. That comes from the article, Syria Elections 2016, U.S. NATO's Failed Attempt to Deny the Will of the Syrian People, by Vanessa Bealey, posted April 14th, originally appearing at 21st Century Wire. Washington is angry because Syria held elections before Washington had time to purchase its slate of politicians and organize Washington-funded NGOs to take to the streets to protest and to claim that Assad had stolen the election. The Western governments are far out on a limb with their lies that the Syrian people prefer to be governed by the Washington-supported terrorists who were overrunning their country and conducting, with Western-supplied weapons, mass murder on the Syrian people until Russia put a stop to it. Now, the Western liars are exposed yet again by election results, and so the liars must pretend that the election lacks validity. Washington's propaganda onslaught against the Syrian elections is clear evidence that Washington has no commitment to the peace accord and simply used the peace process, quote-unquote, in order to prevent the liberation of Raqqa and Idlib from ISIS. Putin and Assad should take note that Washington still intends to overthrow the Syrian government and to install either a puppet or chaos, as in Iraq and Libya. That comes from the article, Syrian Elections Prove Again That Washington and Its Prostitutes Lie Through Their Teeth, by Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, posted April 14th, originally appearing at paulcraigroberts.org. The U.S. government has prioritized one enemy whom it has utterly failed to scare the U.S. public with, while the U.S. government has made a distant second priority of attacking another enemy that most people in the United States are so terrified of they can hardly think straight. President Obama and Secretary Kerry did what they could in 2013 to persuade us to want war with the Syrian government, but they failed. ISIS videos in 2014 succeeded beyond the wildest dreams of ISIS, the Obama administration, and the weapons makers. But the U.S. government jumped into the war in 2014 with the same priority it had had in 2013 and had been developing for years, and which had even helped motivate the 2003 attack on Iraq, namely the goal of overthrowing Syria, a goal for which it has been arming the al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria for years now. This example should help people recognize that public and government motivations for a war are not always the same. That comes from the article, 10 Revealing War Lies, by David Swanson, posted April 13th, originally appearing at Telesur. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Wednesday, April 13th, the Syrian people, in unprecedented numbers, went to the polls and cast their ballots in 7,000 polling stations in the 13 provinces the Assad government controls. Turnout was so high that polls stayed open 5 hours longer to accommodate everyone wishing to vote. According to figures tabulated by Syria's Higher Judicial Committee for Elections, 11,341 candidates contested the election. These elections, however, are taking place at the same time as the first round of Geneva-based peace talks, thereby contradicting and complicating a timetable for political transition insisted upon by the U.S. As a result, a number of Western powers, most notably Germany, France, Great Britain, and the United States, have been rejecting the election results as illegitimate. Later in the show, we'll be speaking to Professor Tim Anderson, author of a recent book on Syria, and who is visiting Damascus this week while elections are taking place. But first, I wanted to touch base with a fellow radio show host and global research contributor about the Syrian situation and how the Western media has chosen to portray it. Stephen Lenman is a blogger, author, and radio host. He has written extensively on world politics, including the current situation in Syria. Mr. Lenman is also the recipient of awards for independent journalism, including the 2008 Project Censored Award and the 2011 Mexican Journalists Club International Journalism Award. Recent books of his include Banker Occupation, Waging Financial War on Humanity, and How Wall Street Fleeces America, Privatized Banking, Government Collusion, and Class War. He's also a frequent contributor to the Global Research website. He joins us now from Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us, Stephen Lenman.
Oh, thanks, Michael. It's great to be on with you.
So, I mean, we're having this conversation at the same time as the peace talks that are going on in Geneva over Syria, as well as just on the heels of these recent elections. So I just wanted to get some of the things that get your state's eye view, your stateside view on that whole crisis and the way the major powers seem to be responding to it. So,
I think the most important thing for listeners to understand is that the war in Syria is not civil. There is nothing whatever civil about it. It's Obama's war. It was made in the USA. Hillary Clinton's dirty hands as Secretary of State were all over this war, the same thing he was involved in raping and destroying Libya. And heaven help us, if she becomes president, she'd probably rape and destroy the entire planet. But that's another issue altogether. We could talk about that another time, Michael. If she gets to be president, maybe we'll need to build a very deep bomb shelter. But again, the war is very much naked aggression. America, the lead instigator, using ISIS and other terrorist groups as imperial foot soldiers. And so many lies and misinformation about this war, the same way it is with all the wars.
Could you give an example of what, could you give an example or a couple of examples, maybe some of the two or three of the more offensive lies surrounding this war?
Well, I think every time I say I want to name this as the biggest one, I say, oh, wait a minute, maybe this other one is the biggest one. But certainly referring to it endlessly as a civil war is one of the major lies. Nothing is said about imported terrorists. The big lie about America waging war on terrorism and specifically on ISIS, America created ISIS and supports this monster and these other terrorist groups, the names really don't mean anything because they can really change from one to another. But basically, we're talking about terrorists supported by America, armed and trained and funded and so on, together with their rogue partners, EU countries, mainly Britain, France, Germany, and regional rogue states, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Israel. Who thinks of Israel as involved in the war in Syria? And just the other day, maybe a day or two ago, Netanyahu admitted, the first time Israel admitted publicly, and the leader, Prime Minister Netanyahu, admitted that Israeli warplanes have bombed Syrian targets dozens of times on the phony pretext of preventing arms from crossing into Lebanon to support Hezbollah. Well, I mean, you can come up with any reason you want to justify the unjustifiable, but Israel very much is part of this war, allied with America and the other nations that I mentioned, and Qatar and Jordan, and so it goes on and on.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess that the narrative keeps changing because, I mean, there's back in 2013, there was that gas attack that was blamed on Assad, and we saw how the Russian government was able to kind of find a sort of a nifty way of sort of changing the channel after Great Britain backed away from participation in an outright military offensive. But it seems pretty clear that it seems as if their first priority of the Western powers is the overthrow of Assad, and they're just trying to find the right kind of pretext that will somehow hook the broader public.
That's exactly right. That's the whole idea why Obama waged war in the first place. And a phrase I've used many times in articles, Obama did not wage war on Syria to quit. And the idea, we'll get into the peace talks, but absolutely regime change is the whole idea. And if they could topple Assad and the officials allied with him, that would be exactly what America wants. And then it would be willing to negotiate anything after that. But those are the things that America will not compromise on. And of course, nothing is said about the fact that Assad is a reformer, not a brutal dictator. Even Bernie Sanders absolutely appalls me by calling Assad a brutal dictator.
I know that Professor Tim Anderson, who we'll be speaking to later, is saying that basically said in a previous interview that he's essentially kind of like a mild-mannered pediatrician or something. Like, you know, it's kind of an absurd depiction. But it's quite Sanders. Remarkable that they can manage to conflate him and demonize him to that extent, eh?
Well, Sanders also called Hugo Chavez, quote, a dead communist dictator. Some populist, huh?
Yeah. I don't know. Since you mentioned both Hillary Clinton and Sanders, I wonder if you could make a really brief comment on, you know, whether you see changes in the wake of a different president, be it Mr. Trump or Ms. Clinton or Mr. Sanders, if they're all so closely aligned that there's no way to depart from it. And I would also add in that I know another fairly prominent and I think credible critic, Robert Perry, has depicted it as a sense of Obama not standing up to the neocons in his midst, which is, I think, is a slightly different emphasis from your own, where you seem to see Obama as a major instigator of all of this.
Well, he's part of this. He's the president. My God, he's the head guy, at least nominally. And I've talked about his neocon-infested administration. My God, Hillary Clinton, the Secretary of State, Victoria Nuland, an Assistant Secretary for the European area, and we know what she did in Ukraine. And there'll be no change whatever, no matter who succeeds Obama, in my opinion.
Yeah, continuity of government.
Whether it's Sanders or Trump or Clinton or the man in the moon, the same dirty system is going to continue. And whatever changes would just be light stuff that really doesn't matter, amount to anything. The major things, the major policies that America pursues will continue to be pursued. And I call it dirty business as usual. And I also emphasize to people to forget what politicians say and only watch what they do. Campaign rhetoric, campaign promises are made to be broken. We saw what Obama did. I mean, he sounded like Sir Galahad riding in on a white horse to save America and save the world. And look what he's done in over 7 years. And if Sanders became president, which is very unlikely, I suppose a possibility, but unlikely, he'd be the same thing. He'd be Obama. He'd be Obama's third term, and if reelected, his fourth term. That's my opinion of Sanders.
Yeah. Well, we don't just go, like we just. I just wanted to return to the election for a moment because I mean, we don't have as yet the final tabulated results, but I'm anticipating that there'll probably be some sort of a validation for Mr. Assad. It's not going to be the huge rout that the Western powers, and that's why we're hearing all this talk about how, oh, these elections aren't legitimate, we don't accept the results, blah, blah, blah. So I'm wondering, in that, given that reality, how you see these election results playing into that broader strategy by Washington about how they're going to react to this. Are we going to be hearing are they going to be pursuing a different course, partition or like what they call the Plan B? Where do you see the rhetoric and the propaganda direction moving now?
Well, I wrote an article I called Obama or America's Plan B is Plan A. It's the overthrow of the Assad government and replacing it with puppets representing America. I think the election will show an overwhelming support for Assad. I can't imagine any other outcome. They did it all by hand-filled out ballots instead of electronic machines, so it takes a little longer to count the ballots and come up with a final result. I'm hoping. I keep checking this to see if anything has come out, but it'll be overwhelming. When Assad was reelected in June 2014, 89% majority, and international monitors monitoring the sites called the election open, free, and fair, and I believe it, absolutely. He's just overwhelmingly popular, which is an added reason why America wants to get rid of him, because he won't support the policies that America wants in the region. He wants Syria to maintain its sovereign independence, and that's the highest of high crimes for a leader to a position for a leader to take. So he has to go the same way Gaddafi had to go and Saddam had to go, even though he was a tyrant, and Assad certainly is not a Saddam. Mm.
Well, how do you see that policy objective being challenged? Can it be challenged? I mean, is it up to the American people to stop this regime, or is there some other way that this this Plan A disguised as Plan B can be halted?
Michael, there's so little reporting on these big geopolitical issues by the U.S. media, and when it is reported, it's in publications like the New York Times, and people, Americans get their, and Canadians too, get their so-called news on television, and you just get the same stuff. I don't watch the stuff, but just I know from the past and what I've seen in the past, you just don't get any coverage of these kind of events. So Americans are oblivious to what's going on in Syria and Ukraine and these other areas where America is waging wars or overthrew governments. So they don't pay any attention to that. What they do pay attention to are pocketbook issues, and Americans are suffering, but I don't see them doing anything about it. They're complaining, but they're not out in the streets protesting the way the people, the way youths and students and others in Paris have been doing for days and days and days, because they want to change the labor laws and make them more onerous on people, and never mind the hardships that the French people have endured because of austerity. Where are the Americans on the streets protesting? There's nothing going on. So whatever happens ahead, you're not going to see Americans do anything to change things.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. I mean, I've been curious about that idea that it seems like we bring out more protesters in the streets when there's a Republican in the White House. But I mean, at the same time, I don't necessarily know what's happening on the streets in America, because I mean, if there are these protests, that chances are they're not going to be reported anyway, right?
The last ones we had, Michael, were the Occupy Wall Street movement. And it was glorious while it lasted, but it was attacked, and it just didn't have the staying power to stick with it, to expand, to fight the system nonviolently. And I guess you could just say the people involved, and I don't know that they were leaders. I think they were just a lot of people that came together and brought more people with them, because a lot of people are angry. But the movement just faded and died away. I'd love to see it reactivated with more staying power to really do something, because the only way anything can change in America, which means changing in the world, is by revolutionary change. If people think they can go to the ballot box and change anything, they're living in a dream world.
Stephen Lendman, can you talk a little bit about a little bit more about the mainstream media distortion? I saw an article recently by Robert Perry, who is gained notoriety as a result of the Iran-Contra coverage. It seems like a very credible journalist in that way. He's relating a lot of facts about Ukraine, for example. And he wrote an article in which he stated he was commiserating with Seymour Hersh about the state of journalism in the country, and basically the emphasis is at how this reporting has deteriorated so much from a bygone era. I'm not sure that. There was ever really a golden age of journalism, because I imagine it was better in the past, and maybe you could comment on that more directly than I could.
I think it was better because there was no cable television, which is the worst of news.
But there's also that high concentration. I mean, I heard like 90. Okay, I don't have the exact numbers handy, but something like 90% of all media is owned by only five or six major corporations.
Oh, yeah.
That's a major component of this, eh?
That's a very major concern. I mean, basically, monopolistic control of the media and of the airways, the public airways, literally given away free to the cable companies and to the broadcasters. And as far as the state of the media, I can remember making comments like, we've gone from Walter Cronkite to Katie Couric, you know, a legitimate journalist who did some important reporting during the Vietnam War that got the Pentagon to change its strategy on embedding journalists as opposed to letting them report freely on what was going on. But we've gone from Cronkite to Couric, an entertainer, just an absolute travesty of news. And I don't know who the anchors are on the other broadcasters, and I don't know who all the people are on the cable news channels, but it's all rubbish, just stuff. I just can't imagine why anybody wastes their time watching it or listening to it. But this is the kind of stuff that Americans get, and they simply know nothing about what's going on because they don't go to the right places. And earlier, in years past, we didn't have the Internet, Michael, as we know. And now we have the Internet, and not everybody, but so many people are connected online. And I've said 15 minutes a day of people spend, they could know more about what's going on than they ever could by going to any other source. But to rely on the major media to find out what's going on, including the New York Times, is guaranteed to assure that you'll know nothing. You'll know what the state wants you to know, not what you need to know.
I'm a little curious about you said a few things just now. There's that mandate to sell widgets and all the different products and sell people on an idea, that promotes consumerism and whatnot. And I'm kind of wondering, just probing that a little bit, how much of this is the need to simplify things just from the standpoint of staying ahead of the competitors versus some sort of conscious desire to con the public into supporting military warfare? Because, I mean, when you're talking about Katie Couric before, I mean, you want to keep things, just for entertainment purposes, it draws audiences, right? And that's not necessarily the same thing. And so if you have simplistic narratives about, Assad the butcher or whatever, it might be so complicated to break through with a more nuanced perspective that you're inclined to just reject it simply because it's not practical.
Well, of course, the media, print or electronic, the businesses. And as a business, I was in small family business throughout most of my working life. And, of course, the object of a business, the objective of a business is to make money, to stay alive, and make a profit, be able to pay the salaries of the people working with you, earn a decent living. So that's the number one objective of the media. As far as the broadcasters goes, news is just a tiny bit of what they do. Most of their broadcasting are, what do they do during the day, soap operas or game shows? Or
reality television.
the stuff they show in the evening.
The Apprentice.
This is where the big money, sports, of course. the big money in all of these things. And news is just a sideline. I don't think they make any money in news. They just do it because I guess they got to do something. But the day may come when they end their newscasts because I think they're losing propositions for them. But if they have newscasts, they're part of the system and they need to support the government, so you'll get propaganda instead of real news and information. And that's a sad. A lot of people know it and still tune in and don't realize with minimum effort they can learn what's going on and maybe get angry like you and me, Michael, and want to do something about it.
Okay, so you maybe have a closing comment about the current situation in Syria, possibly a teaser for your upcoming article?
Well, let's talk about, very briefly talk about the peace talks, which I call farcical peace talks. They've gone nowhere in a little over 2 weeks. They're in their third week now. There was about a two-week break in between, and now they resume talks on the 13th. So we're into the third day of the resumed talks, or maybe the second. I think the Syrian delegation showed up yesterday, so they're into talks now. And the initial ones were proximity talks in separate rooms with the pro-Western mediator, Stefan de Mistura, handling things, the maestro, the Western maestro. And, I mean, they're going nowhere because the only thing the opposition wants and America wants is to get rid of Assad. And that's the one thing the Syrians will never go along with, nor should they. And they have Russia on their side, they have international law on their side, and the deputy foreign minister the other day, I quoted him saying, the idea of insisting Assad must go is nothing other than a coup d'etat, and they're not going to stand for it, they're not going to put up with it, and I support them 100%.
Okay, Stephen Ledman, I want to thank you very much for joining us. It's been great having you back on the show.
Oh, thank you, Michael. Good being with you.
We've been joined by Stephen Ledman, author, blogger, and host of the Progressive Radio News Hour, which airs Sundays from noon to 1 p.m. Central Time on the Progressive Radio Network. And, of course, his articles appear frequently on the Global Research website. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. We're joined right now by phone by Professor Tim Anderson. Professor Anderson is a senior lecturer in political economy at the University of Sydney in Sydney, Australia. He's a frequent contributor to the Global Research website and the author of the recently released book, The Dirty War on Syria. He joins us right now from Damascus, where he's been observing the situation in the lead up to the parliamentary elections, which are taking place as we speak. So good evening, Professor Anderson. Okay. So I guess I first of all just wanted to ask you if there's since the elections are happening right now, what we're hearing is that there's been a very a large turnout. They've extended the election by about 5 hours. Am I correct about that?
Yes. I'm not sure of the scale of the turnout yet. But they say there's been a strong turnout, and there's certainly been a very strong participation of candidates and thousands of candidates.
So, Professor Anderson, I'm curious to know, what do you anticipate in terms of the way the parliamentary elections will play out? I know that the voting is taking place as we speak. What are you anticipating, given what your sense of things on the ground?
It's not really possible to make any predictions. There aren't any provisional figures as yet. They say they'll have a result probably about this time tomorrow, in another 24 hours. Say about 24 hours. I think maybe the polling is still going on now, but another 24 hours. But from the candidates, you can see that there's a much wider variety of candidates. Everyone's commented on that. To what extent they're going to get any vote, I'm not sure. In the previous elections, the last party got about 60% of the vote. And the smaller parties, none of the smaller parties really got a huge... They ended up with one, two, three members of parliament, the other range of other small parties. But there's a lot of individuals and new groups that have appeared in this election. So it's not really possible to make any predictions yet.
OK. Okay, fair enough. But can you talk about what is being discussed in terms of election issues? Is it essentially, is there any sense of it being a referendum on Assad, or are there any specific policy choices? What are the people, would you say, voting on? What's being discussed on the campaign trail?
I think there's, first of all, there's a very strong, there's a great economic depression here, effectively. The economy has been devastated by the war and by the sanctions imposed by the US and Europeans and some others. So to the extent of the real substantial issues, and remember that these people participating in elections exclude all of those armed groups, effectively, the groups that come out of Riyadh and which the US calls an opposition. They're not really an opposition at all. They just want to create an Islamic state of some sort. So the opposition parties here are loyal in the sense of being against the terrorist groups and trying to rebuild the country. But there's tremendous economic difficulties here. And there has been some improvement, for example, in recent months. The ceasefire did, in fact, have an impact in certain areas, including in East Damascus. But the prices are high and the salaries are low and there are shortages, all those sorts of things. The combined result of the terrorism and the economic sanctions by the Western bloc. So people, in substance, people want a change in that. Beyond that, there is a sense that new types of people having a say in the system. It's quite visible, the greater participation of women in the amongst the candidates, for example. So those sorts of things have a more general sort of sense of, well, maybe people can have a bit more of a say in the system.
Now, we've heard from major powers that they're questioning the legitimacy of these elections. You got Germany saying they won't recognize the results. Great Britain, I got a quote from a spokesperson, "The decision of the regime to hold elections is a measure of how divorced it is from reality. They cannot buy back legitimacy by putting up a flimsy facade of democracy." And then the France's foreign ministry calls the election a sham by an oppressive regime. And, of course, the U.S. State Department is saying the elections do not reflect the will of the people. So I'm wondering what you would say to those sort, you know, people who are, you know, kind of listening to those sorts of criticisms about the legitimacy of these elections.
Yes. Well, these are statements from people who have no real interest in democracy in Syria. They certainly have no accountability for it. The United Nations resolution, the last one from the Security Council, December last year, said only the Syrians can decide their future. And the US has signed up to that, and the Europeans have signed up to that. It was a unanimous resolution saying that. Western powers don't seem to understand that. They don't understand what it means that Syrian people decide their future. It means that if they have to change the constitution, the Syrian people have to do it. The Syrian people vote for the representatives. They don't seem to understand that. The Al-Qaeda groups that they back, of course, the Riyadh opposition coming out of Saudi Arabia, have never expressed any interest in democracy or elections. They want to overthrow the government and establish a sort of Islamic state. The U.S. has been very clear that they want to overthrow the Syrian government. They are arming groups to do precisely that. You really have to, you know, look at any statements they make about Syrian democracy in that sort of context. They have no real interest in Syrian democracy. Syria is the most inclusive nation in the entire Middle East region, in say it's not religious-based or racially-based, and it has public institutions, inclusive institutions. And they have a voting process which gets a higher level of participation than the United States does in presidential elections. So these are all smoke screens, really. And I think the good side of that story is that it doesn't really affect the Syrian people in their internal processes. And as I said before, it makes some people more determined to go out and vote, even if they're a bit indifferent to it, because they know. know that the Americans and Saudi Arabia or Turkey are enemies, effectively, don't want them to vote. So we'll both be facing that.
I'm just wanting to ask about the fact that these elections are taking place in the shadow of these UN-led peace talks in Geneva. They took effect, the ceasefire taking effect February 27th, but we've seen an escalation in fighting in northern Aleppo province, in parts of Hama province and Damascus, as I understand it. What can you tell us about what's instigating that violence and why?
It is quite complicated in a way because, on the one hand, I've heard very convincingly across the board that people say the ceasefire had a very important effect, certainly in Damascus. That is to say, the almost daily shellings that were happening in the eastern part of Damascus from the sectarian groups stopped. It largely stopped. They were surprised it was so relatively peaceful, partly because of the successes of the Syrian army in bringing a cordon around those occupied areas and diminishing them somewhat, but also because there was some genuine engagement in the ceasefire and so some actual benefit to ordinary people, probably because the armed groups were trying to regroup themselves in place to defeat. And that's in Damascus. Now, you rightly mentioned that in Aleppo, the situation is rather different because the Syrian army and the alliance led by the Syrian army with Russia and Iran and Hezbollah and some other groups, having liberated Palmyra a short time ago, they've been trying to cut off the supply routes between Deir ez-Zor and Raqqa and Aleppo. So they're trying to encircle Aleppo at the moment. And there's been a counteroffensive by Jabhat al-Nusra from the north, the groups that come in from the north. There's a couple of other groups that work with Jabhat al-Nusra, Jaish al-Islam and the Ara al-Sham. So those groups have mounted a counteroffensive at the very time that the Syrian army is doing a push to clean out the entirety of Aleppo. Aleppo, the second biggest city in Syria, is the main target of the Syrian army after Palmyra, except that there are some small strategic areas in between. And it's a standard operation to cut off the supply routes, cut off the links between the concentrations of those Islamist groups and their links to Turkey. And so there's a genuinely large battle going on in Aleppo at the moment. And it meant that some of the groups who were indeed, let's say, taking advantage of the ceasefire had breached it. The Russians have been monitoring those breaches, so many per day and so on, but effectively there's abandoning of the ceasefire in large parts of Aleppo where the fighting's going on. But it's been maintained more or less in the northeastern part of Damascus at the moment. So it's a complicated situation, but it means that the big focus of fighting now is indeed in Aleppo.
So I'm wondering, as we move forward, what do you see should the elections go in a way that supports or backs Mr. Assad? What do you see the international? How do you see things sort of resolving themselves in the international stage? Are we going to see increased efforts to kind of intimidate the government, or are we going to see compromises on one side or the other? Where do you see things going?
First of all, I think it's important to recognize that there are two different things going on, the Syrian internal process and the Geneva process. And both are very important. The Geneva process is important because the ceasefire has brought some genuine results, at least in Damascus. And it's also very necessary part of ending a war that every effort is made to try and resolve violence without further deaths. We should be very clear that there is no political resolution in terms of a new Syrian government going to come out of the Geneva process. That is simply not going to happen. Indeed, it's contrary to the wording of the Security Council resolution. Although, you know, there is this illusion in the Western countries that somehow or other these external, despite the Security Council resolution that says the Syrian people have to resolve their own political processes, there is still this insistence that these international players are going to somehow shape the next Syrian government. That's not going to happen. It's particularly not going to happen because the Syrian advances on the battlefield have got the advantage, you know, in the last few months. So, whereas internally in the political process in Syria, there is the process of elections that includes the Congress elections back in 2012, 4 years ago, the amendments to the constitution in 2012, the presidential elections in 2014, and the Congress elections today are all according to Syrian law. That is to say, there hasn't been a failure to comply with the schedule of elections under the electoral law and the constitution. So when people have said in the past through all those elections, oh, it's not the time to have an election because there's a war going on and so on. Well, yes, but the government has pursued without delays, any sort of illegal or unconstitutional delays in all those elections. So the election today really has nothing to do with the Geneva process. The Geneva process remains important because it's a way of attempting to resolve the conflict and also to perhaps isolate the states that have been sending all of these goods from back to all of the other groups there. And that's why the war is so long. It's not a civil war, of course. It's a war that's been backed by the close allies of the United States, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Qatar, and Israel.
Okay, so you were talking about the impacts of the sanctions, and I know you wrote in your book, you devoted a whole chapter to the system of the attacks on Syria's health system, and focused on how the sanctions were essentially maybe, you know, there was clearly driving away and alienating popular support. So this is essentially an effort to just completely destroy and degrade the Syrian state and its capacity to provide support for the people, you know, all those social institutions that were in place. I don't know, is it possible to provide an analog? Is it to compare it, say, directly to Haiti or Libya? How would you describe that whole situation of that effort, strategy of just, you know, undermining that the state's ability to support its own people?
Yes, so that's certainly part of the Washington strategy, that on one side you've got armed groups attacking, for example, pharmaceutical factories, you know, and hospitals. They've got their own pretext for it. This hospital was treating soldiers, therefore, you know, we're going to blow it up, and they filmed it themselves blowing it up and so on. And on the other hand, you've got international sanctions, which make a lot of things very difficult to obtain. Syria has been very self-sufficient in the past, because there had been sanctions in the past too, in a lot of areas like food and pharmaceuticals and so on, but they're much weaker in that sense today. The economic damage is very real. While the Syrian alliance is a tremendous armed force these days, and despite the loss of soldiers, and they've lost at least in the order of 80,000 soldiers in this conflict, so a third or more of all the casualties in the conflict have been Syrian security forces. Despite that, experience that the army has gained has strengthened it, and the alliances make it very strong. But we've got this economic degradation going on at the same time. So there is still a public health system and a public education system, but it's lost a lot in terms of resources, in terms of people. Part of the immigration problem, the refugee problem, is because professionals are paying because it's very difficult for those people too. So I heard today from some people, and it's also universities, for example, is very strong. A lot of doctors, that sort of area has been damaged. So even today I was talking to one group that was setting up a new private university because they were trying to rebuild a type of capacity in the higher education sector that was being weakened, undermined. There are many, many young people studying in the schools and hospitals in Syria, but you know their classes are getting bigger and bigger, and the possibilities of small group teaching and so on. So there's a very strong impact on the economy. As I mentioned before, shortages in prices and so on. That's going on at the same time, and that's aggravated by these sanctions. Of course, we know what happened with Iraq, for example, in the sanctions during the 90s. They left a terrible toll because they went on so long. You remember that famous question to Madeleine Albright? It was estimated that 500,000 children had died as a result of those sanctions, and they asked her, was it worth it? And she said, well, we think it is. You know, those sanctions are a long-term thing that have really, at the other side of the terrorism here and the real damage to people, and that side is kicking in. And I think the one advantage Syria has is it's had some very strong, loyal partners, particularly Iran and Russia, but also countries like Cuba and Venezuela that are helping in reconstructing the health sector, for example. So people are living in a very difficult situation here at the same time as the Syrian armed forces have got the initiative.
Okay, we are joined now once again by Professor Tim Anderson. I'm speaking to him now almost 2 days after our previous conversation to see if he has any updates on how the Syrian elections went and how he sees the political landscape shifting. Welcome back, Professor Anderson.
Thanks, Michael.
So it's been more than 24 hours since the polls closed, but I have yet to see anything in the English-speaking press about the election other than commentaries from Western governments about how they were illegitimate. We talked about that before, but I was wondering if there's anything more you can tell me from your vantage point about how the elections went.
Just a little bit about the participation. The figures aren't out yet. They aren't published yet. I haven't seen them yet. The polls were extended by some hours, possibly into yesterday morning. So it's that far after the close of polls. They were anticipating to have results last night, but maybe the polls will be coming out later on this afternoon. The thing I've heard back is that the level of participation has been fairly strong. Not as high as the presidential election in 2014. You might recall that was around 73% between that, despite the war and some parts of the country that couldn't get to vote. On this occasion, and the Congress elections always have a lower participation than the presidential election. Back in 2012, it was only about 51%, also during the crisis. Now, everyone is telling me that it's higher. It's not as high as the presidential, but it's higher than the last Congress, so maybe 60-something percent. Not entirely clear, but they say it was pretty strong. And I think the factor there was that there has been quite an explosion of new candidates, particularly young people and women, which has sort of interested a lot of people. The participation around the university was quite strong, apparently. And in the past, young people hadn't voted that much, particularly in the People's Assembly election. So that's about all I've got to say, that people, it was peaceful. There weren't any particular incidents. There was one incident of corruption in Aleppo, which was uncovered. And there's a previous election in particular areas. And people are being charged over the way that the election is up there. Another thing to remember here is that there's still a lot of internally displaced people. There has been a significant return of people to some areas, particularly around Homs and parts of Damascus. But the point is for people who have been displaced, say in Aleppo and Hamas, or Gaza and so on, they have polling booths in Damascus and on the coastal cities and so on. So there has been some facility made for people who
out of their districts that wanting to vote for their local candidates.
Okay. So, yeah, you're talking, when you talk about those internally displaced persons from those areas, do we have, can you estimate the percentage of people that, are there any estimates on, like, what percentage could have actually cast a ballot?
Well, as I said, the participation rate is probably 60-something percent, but I don't know exactly what yet. And that means of eligible voters in the whole country. So when I said that there was 73% participated in the presidential elections, that means that 73% of eligible voters in the entire country, including the internally displaced people. I'm not exactly sure how that factors in people in the rest of the country, but there's always been at least twice as many people internally displaced as externally displaced. So that's a little bit unclear. There was a report a few days ago from the Asylum Minister and the Internal Organisation of Migration saying that 1.7 million people were moving back to their homes now. So that's pretty much the fruit of the advances of the Syrian army with its allies in the last 6 months. 1.7 million, that's possibly heading towards a third of the people who were internally displaced. But when we talk about a participation rate, they're referring to the number of eligible people.
Well, what might conceivably be at stake here? I mean, it seems my understanding is that the president Assad does wield most of the power in the country. What kinds of restraints or how could the parliament shape the plans or the efforts of the president?
Well, the parliament are lawmakers, so it's quite similar in structure, really, to the Congress presidential system in the US. The president has executive powers, and in the past he was the head of the Ba'ath Party, but the Ba'ath Party since 2012 no longer has the same constitutional role now. They were always other parties, but the role of the Ba'ath Party was more or less diminished in 2012 with the constitutional amendment. So now President Assad is pretty much like the US president in many respects.
Hmm. Do you have any kind of a read on how like as we discussed the rhetoric from the United States and Germany and so on, I mean, but like in terms of the real politic of the situation, do you as I brought up before, how do you see them reshaping their approach? I know there's been talk about what they call a Plan B for Syria. I think they're talking about some sort of a partitioning. Realistically, do you want to maybe address that point again?
Yeah, well, that's always the US plan. We know from the intelligence documents that they're very happy with the idea of an Islamic State in the east part of the country, driven by Al-Qaeda and the other Salafi groups that align with it. So that idea of partition is always a classical tool of imperial powers, but it's explicitly been on the US agenda from the beginning. It's clear also that's not going to happen because effectively the role of outside states is diminishing pretty much in line with the security advances of the Syrian army and its allies, particularly, of course, Iran, Hezbollah and Russia. So I think it's fair to say that while the Geneva process or the international process is important in terms of trying to end the war, because there are so many external sponsors of these groups, it's pretty clear that the Geneva process is not going to have any real influence on shaping the future political system of Syria. It's important to end the war, but it's not really going to do it. What's going to do it is really what's happening here at the moment, which is very much a normal process in many respects. It's just that people are devastated by this war, and economically, here's the dilemma for Syrians at the moment. Economically, they're worse off. The economy is being damaged very seriously by the terrorist groups, and at the same time, you've got international sanctions from those same countries who are demanding the overthrow of the government. And those sanctions, of course, have led to shortages and higher prices and wages are lower. So you could say that most of the country's in poverty in dollar terms, but there's very strong bonds that help people survive. But and so those have been the issues, I think, really, that people are really concerned about when it comes to this election this week, that what's going to happen to the economy, what about the basic needs of people here. I heard there was a conference just recently, a few days ago, where the government had set up with the idea that people were going to discuss the external situation, the threats to Syria. And most of the delegates there wanted to talk about, basic things like prices and food and a range of other economic issues, basically. But they're the burdens of issues of this election and the presidential election 2 years ago, because effectively the political process here is taking up within a broad consensus against external intervention and against the better groups attacking cities and the state institutions.
Thank you so much for helping us decode what's been going on out there, sir.
No problem, Michael. Thanks for your time.
Been speaking with Professor Tim Anderson. The book is The Dirty War on Syria, and it is now available through the Global Research website.